Today from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, Ivanka Trump says there's a special place in hell for Roy Moore, the man her father just endorsed. What would his election say about America's progress on sexual misconduct? We'll ask you. Then we'll ask MIT economist John Gruber, what's up with the tax bill? We'll discuss winners, losers, and likely outcome. Then at noon, medical ethicist Art Kaplan on CVS purchase of Aetna and what it will mean for healthcare. And you can't afford a real shink? Well, have we got a wobot for you?
We'll open the lines and ask you about the robots Jim just mentioned. What are they? They're robot shrinks. Could you go for one or not?
You better believe it.
Corby Comer, our food man, asks if becoming a chef could be bad for your health. Gun control activist John Rosenthal sends lawmakers graphic images of gun violence victims. He joins us to explain. Then Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane on decades and decades of tax reform. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It is Tuesday. We are broadcasting live from our studio at the Boston Public Library. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, good. Was that a surprise, the question? You look shocked that I was.
I wasn't sure how I was doing, Jim. I had to think about it for a couple of minutes.
So Donald Trump and Steve Bannon's plan was to blow up the Republican Party. As you know, is the candidacy of Roy Moore their first successful detonation? 3 weeks ago, here's a little bit of history. The RNC cut off Moore from its coffers after the number of sexual assault accusations multiplied. Nothing has changed since then. In fact, more women have come forward and more evidence has emerged. What has changed, however, is that Trump has given Moore a resounding endorsement, even though his daughter, remember, said that there was a place in hell for people like Roy Moore. Well, Trump's action prompted the RNC to open its purse strings again, emboldening other Republican leaders to show their support. Mitt Romney, though, is not among them. The presidential candidate, whose worst defense against women was to put them in binders, if you recall, tweeted, and good for Romney, quote, Roy Moore in the U.S. Senate would be a stain on the GOP and the nation. Lee Korfman and other victims are courageous heroes. No vote, no majority is worth losing our honor, our integrity. For people like Romney, it's a dark day for the GOP. I would argue it's broader than the GOP. Is it a dark day for you? What does it say about the progress that people like Marjorie and I, on some upbeat moments, believe we are making on the sexual misconduct front when there is this flood of endorsements, maybe from Alabama voters as well, for Moore? Or is this all an oversimplification of something that has been eroding politics long before Moore? Does this go back to, say, Bill Clinton, to an era where sexual misconduct in politics became normalized? 877-301-8970. I know he's one of your favorite politicians, mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell. So can I play for you a little? McConnell 2 weeks ago telling reporters Moore should step down. And then McConnell on Sunday telling ABC's This Week that we should let the, quote, the people in Alabama decide. Here's McConnell then and now.
Are you calling for him to step down from that Senate race?
I did. I think he should step aside.
Do you believe these allegations to be true?
I believe the women, yes.
I think we're going to let the people of Alabama decide a week from Tuesday who they want to send to the Senate, and then we'll address the matter appropriately.
Do you believe that Judge Moore should be in the Senate?
I'm going to let the people of Alabama make the call. This election's been going on a long time. There's been a lot of discussion about it. They're going to make the decision a week from Tuesday.
You know, in all fairness, Marjorie, I know this upsets you.
Yep.
You can't argue, since you believe in diversity, there's mm-hmm. got to be a place for child molesters in the Senate. You know, by the way, how do you think Ivanka Trump feels? To her credit, early on, and most of us, including me, naively thought that she was speaking as a surrogate for her father a couple of weeks ago when she said that line about there's a place in hell for people
right.
like Roy Moore. How do you think she feels that not only is her father not on board, but he gave this full-throated endorsement to a guy who is credibly charged as being a child molester?
Well, her father is accused by teenage beauty contest pageants of spying on them when they were undressed in their dressing room. And not to mention the other adult woman who charged him with grabbing their whatevers and shoving them against the walls and everything else. So she's the daughter of a credibly accused, I guess, child peeper, you could call him, and woman harasser.
So let's assume, so far we only have the RNC throwing money back. We have Mitch McConnell doing a flip. We have Roy Moore say that Donald Trump said to him on the phone, go, Roy, go, or something
yeah.
like that. So we're, what are we, 7 days away for an election. You are, it makes me really happy to be with you in this context, really positive about the Me Too movement, what's happened since Harvey
right.
Weinstein. Roy Moore's elected, admittedly from Alabama, next Tuesday. What's your position on Wednesday about where we are?
I think that this is a very bad time for the Republicans on this. I mean, you know, you can certainly point out the Democrats were terrible with Bill Clinton, and they were. Nancy Pelosi was terrible about John Conyers, and she was,
Conyers.
Although John Conyers is now is resigned. He's stepping down. She was wishy-washy on that. Al Franken is still there. The Democrats haven't been perfect. But this is very embarrassing, I think, for the Republicans, because this guy, as we all know, was banned from a shopping mall for trolling for teenagers years ago. It's very hard to say that these charges aren't true. And you have this new woman that just came out, you know, and said that here she has her the card he gave her in his handwriting when she graduated from high school, wishing her well. Other women have.
She's not claiming that he sexually molested her.
No, she's
what
not.
She said,
they were dating.
She was silent mm-hmm. until her name was mentioned. She was fine with this until.
He
and she's
called
a
her
Republican.
A liar.
Called her a liar, and she
right.
said, I'm not going to stand for this.
Exactly.
She goes up to her attic and finds all these notes
he's
and
called,
yearbook signings.
He's called all these women liars, and Trump
Roy
has
Moore
called
has.
All these women liars, too. So it's sort of a sad state of affairs. But our old colleague from WTKK, Michael Graham, had a great point, pointing out that Alabama is an extremely conservative place. And it reminds me of the old line about that Barney Frank used to have about pro-life people. His idea
One
was,
of the best lines
you know,
ever.
Their view is that, and I'm paraphrasing, but that life begins at conception and
ends at birth.
So it seems that the people in Alabama are so concerned about abortion that what happens to people after they're born is less of a concern to them, and that he's running against, in Michael's analysis, that Doug Jones is too far, too progressive of a Democrat, and that's the reason that they can't bear to vote for him, because he doesn't want to build the wall.
Well, Michael Graham, and this is a piece on CBS News website
yep.
that Graham wrote. Graham makes a third point that is not the most original, but it's an important one, is everything is context. And while most people would not suggest that Al Franken on his worst day is in the same class mm-hmm. as Roy Moore, when the Democrats were so wishy-washy early on about Conyers, as you said, until that woman came out last week, and that Al Franken is almost like yesterday's news,
right.
who has talked about his problems. In fact, I saw a tweet from him last night about Bears Mountain or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about protecting the environment almost as if nothing happened. I'm back at work. The point that Graham makes, which I think is a good one, is, you know, it isn't like the Democrats are pure enough for them to be going on the assault on Roy Moore, even though I would argue that molesting a child is exponentially worse than anything that's being suggested about Frank, and maybe not Conyers, but who knows. Our number is 877-301-8970. So what's your reaction? The RNC is back. The Republican National Committee is back on board with its money for Roy Moore. Donald Trump is a full-throated Roy Moore supporter and the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, who used to think that Roy Moore should pull out 3 weeks ago, now thinks the people of Alabama should decide.
You know, this guy is going to be a big embarrassment if he does win and he does get to the Senate
you.
Because he's up there talking about, he thinks that gay people, he's talking about them as sodomites and all this gross language, and he's absolutely backwards on a lot of progressive issues, and he's got some very shady financial dealings, money that he made and did not report in his taxes. So he's shady on a million different fronts in addition to his problems with women. And when you have these women producing evidence of letters he wrote to them, and it's his handwriting, it's really, I can't believe that people,
fake
you know,
news.
I guess the whole thing is, we're sort of reached, I don't know if this is a moral low point in our politics, but it's pretty close, because when you combine what's happening on tax reform, what's happening to the environment, and what's happening with the president and Roy Moore, it seems like all of a piece that, you know, doesn't matter the morality of it anymore.
Well, how about harken back to what I said in the end of my introduction here, and then we'll get to your calls at 877-301-8970. We've discussed this ad nauseum, but with the exception of you and a few others, we're people, Democrats, not liberals, covering for Bill Clinton?
Yes.
In exactly the same way Republicans are covering for Roy Moore?
Well, right. But I think that the 90s was a different time because, of course, we all know that Anita Hill got up there and told the truth, in my estimation, about what happened with Clarence Thomas. And there were other women that never got to testify that were going to say the same things about Clarence Thomas. So it wasn't just Anita Hill. And she was called a little nutty and a little slutty. And Clarence Thomas was appointed to the Supreme Court. That was in 1991, 1992. Bill Clinton's were, we knew about Jennifer Flowers beforehand. The rest of his stuff came out during the 90s. We were in much worse.
Jennifer Flowers was not a crime.
No, she was not. He was having an affair. We all remember that. She got on the 60 Minutes thing when Hillary Clinton said she was not Tammy Wynette standing by her man, but she was going to stand by her husband in the Jennifer Flowers situation. Then later, most of America learned about these other awful things about harassment. Winita Broderick has said that Bill Clinton had actually raped her, and I think she was very credible when she said that. It was a different time for sex harassment, and I think, as I've said a million times, feminists really disgrace themselves by standing by him. But we are 20 years later now, or 30 years later, whatever we are, 25 years later, and I think we've come a long way. I don't think this is going to end up well for the Republicans.
You mean if he ends up winning in particular?
No, I don't think so, because he's such a creepy guy in a million other ways that he's really kind of disgraceful.
Well, you know, the last thing I'll say about this is while you can say, well, it's Alabama, Donald Trump's 59% approval in Alabama, the fact that you don't hear many Republicans, including Susan Collins, who used to revere from Maine, saying that he should be expelled should he be elected. You don't hear much of that talk anymore. So I would argue that Republican senators from other states are just as culpable on this if the people of Alabama say yes.
Where are the other Republican women? Where's Nikki Haley down at the UN? Is she in favor of child molesters getting into the United States Senate? And Laura Trump, by the way, who's the wife of Eric Trump, is doing robocalls for
Roy Moore, for the president
in Alabama. Yes. And Ivanka Trump has, I guess, decided to shut up. I think those of us who thought she was going to be a great champion for women obviously have been sorely disappointed.
877-301-8970. Let's start with John and Gardner. You're first on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Hey there, John.
Good morning, kids. How are you all?
Great.
Jim, you talked about some naivete on your pod yesterday. I would argue it was dopiness. But
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I have some naivete and then another thought. Well, actually, doesn't this line, we want the Alabamians to decide for themselves now, this new party line, is that not reminiscent of the party line when I'm not accusing Obama of being, I'm not a birther, but we'll let people decide for their own. Mm. How many people went around, that was the party line then, right? Just don't answer the question and say we're going to leave it to these
people. Well, Donald Trump is answering the question. Mitch McConnell may not be, but Trump is all in. Well, I mean, he is a big-time Roy Moore supporter.
And Roy Moore is a big birther, too.
Yeah.
Charles Barkley called him a white supremacist.
He did.
What a surprise he's in on that, huh? Here's my naive tip. By the way, sometimes one has repetitive duties in life, and they're a pain in the neck, and sometimes they're a pleasure. Marjorie, another fine column in yesterday's Boston.
Oh, thank you. And the point of which is another reason why I'm encouraged, is that I think women are and fathers, too, but mostly mothers are raising their children much differently now. The idea that you have to... you know, that you do not owe physical closeness to anybody because they're nice to you or because they buy you a gift, that you own your own body. And that's not something that...
This generation, as opposed to the prior one, where it was almost the price of admission.
Well, the classic example is the creepy uncle that would come over at Christmas or come over at Thanksgiving and, you know, he hugged you a little bit too close and you knew it was really creepy and kind of awful and your mother would say... Or your father would say, hey, you know, he's only here for a couple of minutes. Don't hurt his feelings. It's only once a year. I think that we have moved beyond that you don't have to do that anymore. And it's a lesson learned early by young women about their bodies and powerful men.
You have another point, John, or are you done?
Yes, I do. I'm gathering, by the way, you may have drawn a little bit from your personal life on that, Marjorie, but you don't have to answer that. My other thought is on my naivete.
Yeah.
Marjorie, do you think there's any chance that there's younger women and hopefully men, and then even some not-so-young women in Alabama that aren't telling their husband or boyfriend or their mother or father how they feel, but that they feel as creeped out as some of us up here do, and that I have a little bit of hope that Jones is going to carry the day.
I think it's the exact opposite. I think some people are too embarrassed to say that they're supporting a child molester. And if I had a bet, if the polls are off, I hope you're right. They're not off in your direction. They're off in the other direction that he's going to win bigger. And by the way, I'm sure you know, John, one poll yesterday had him up 5 or 6 points. This is Roy Moore. One had him down 3, so we shall see. John, thank you for the call, as always. 877-301-8970.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, Alabama is a very conservative state. I mean, he's in Alabama, the president has a 96% approval rating among Republicans. I'm taking this from 59 overall, really, and 96% among Republicans.
71% of Republicans in that same poll, I think it's the same poll, don't believe any of the allegations against Roy Moore, by the way. 71%.
Yeah, that's the one that really gets me.
You know, you mentioned a minute ago that a critical issue in this race is Roy Moore is, to put it mildly, passionately pro-life, and Doug Jones is pro-choice in a state that's overwhelmingly pro-life. There was a great exchange this morning. Roy Moore spokeswoman Janet Porter was on with Poppy Harlow on CNN this morning. She's pregnant, Poppy Harlow. Mentions Harlow's baby twice while defending Moore against Jones. Just listen to this.
Thank you for joining us. And let me get right to it.
So thank you. It's great to be with you. And by the way, congratulations on your unborn child. That's the reason why I came down as a volunteer to speak for Judge Roy Moore, because he'll stand for the rights of babies like yours in the womb, where his opponent will support killing them up until the moment of birth.
Janet, thank you for being with us, and I appreciate the congratulations on our son on the way.
If you care about child abuse, you should be talking about the fact that Judge Roy Moore stands for protection, not only of our Second Amendment rights so we can protect ourselves against predators, for the rights of babies like your 8-month baby that you're carrying now. Doug Jones says you can take the life of that baby, and we should pay for
it. Let's leave my child out of this.
Good for Poppy Harlow.
You know, abortion is legal up to 6 months.
He doesn't believe in the Constitution, as evidenced by the fact he was removed twice as Chief Justice.
And we should point out that almost nobody is getting abortions up to 6 months. The vast majority of abortions are formed in the first 12 weeks. And if it weren't, this is what kills me about the anti-abortion people, that the inability of women to get abortions early because of restrictions that are all across the country means they ultimately do get the abortions. But we're talking about not a 6-week abortion or an 8-week abortion. We're talking about a 10, 12, or 14-week abortion. Nobody's getting aborting 8-month-old babies. That's just ridiculous.
By the way, we're just told by our colleagues in the control room, remember we were discussing with Charlie Sennett yesterday the whole issue of Trump moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Charlie thought it wouldn't happen. He convinced me. I don't know what the news source is, but Trump has apparently told the CNN, thank you, the head of the Palestinian Authority, that the U.S. plans to move its embassy to Jerusalem. Let's go to Tim in Rhode Island. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Jan and Marjorie. Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate
it. Sure.
I'll make it quick. First, Marjorie, I want to salute you for a wonderful, important column yesterday.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderfully written, brave of you to share. And for men who think and were raised to respect women, I believe that you caused them to think too, and I think it's marvelous.
Thank you.
Secondly, well, it was very brave of you, and truly an important column. Thank you for writing it. Secondly, Roy Moore, I believe, Trump endorsing him, as awful as it is, what this goes down to for me, and I follow politics for most of my life, as both of you do and have, it's just about power. All our system is about is gaining power, holding power. It's seven lobbyists, and Republicans have got no leg to stand on as far as being deficit hawks for the $1.4 trillion deficit, or $1.4 trillion in spending, which is going to happen over the next 10 years. So it's just down to it's just a matter of Americans, enough Americans, being able to see their dripping hypocrisy.
Well, you know, I have to say, for whatever it's worth, Tim, just to make it slightly bipartisan, I would argue until John Conyers gave a huge break to the Democratic leaders in the House of Representatives, they deserve a capital H on their chest as well for hypocrisy. If you're zero tolerance, you're zero tolerance for your own as well as the opposition's. And their position, particularly Nancy Pelosi's early position until she flipped on Conyers, to me is unconscionable. But thank you very much for your call, Tim. 877-301-8970. Boy, they got a break today. If assuming that Conyers, that little sound we heard a few minutes ago, from Henry Santoro is actually, or NPR, wherever it was, is stepping down, retiring today. The Pelosi's of the world got a big break.
Hey, I just want to answer Tom and other people that are saying this is a partisan thing for me. It absolutely isn't, Tom, et cetera. It's not just Moore's accusers, I believe. I believe Al Franken's, I believe Conyers, and I believe Bill Clinton's way back when. And please go look at the Boston Herald if you don't believe me and see what I wrote about it. But, Tom, nice try. Anyway, we are talking about the RNC throwing its support behind Roy Moore, asking you if this is a new low for the GOP. That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the fact that the RNC, Republican National Committee, flipped, Mitch McConnell flipped, and most importantly, the President of the United States flipped, now supporting Roy Moore in a full-throated way. What does this mean, and what does it mean for the progress that most of us think we've made in the last month or two since the accusations were outed about Harvey Weinstein? This election is 7 days away. I think that, you know, if... And by the way, that emailer aggravated me too, and I try to stay measured. You can't be listening to the show and say this is a partisan attack on Roy Moore. On day one, we said Conyers had to go. We've been saying the same thing about Bill Clinton forever. I mean, really.
And
I
Joe
mean,
Benaki,
and by the way, that's like the last refuge of scoundrels. What are you, defending Roy Moore by accusing us of partisanship? The guy is a credibly accused child molester who the President of the United States is endorsing for a seat in the United States Senate. I mean, really.
Joan Vernacki's got a good piece in the Globe saying, when is enough of Bill Clinton enough? And her point is he's getting paid for these big speeches, and he's still a darling of the Democrats, and he's writing op-ed pieces, and maybe it's time that he gave a shut up.
Well, who said to us either on the radio or on Greater Boston to me last week, we will never see Bill Clinton invited to do another – it was Chuck Todd. Chuck Todd told us on the radio, I don't think you're ever going to see Bill Clinton invited to another candidate rally or a Democratic candidate seeking his endorsement for election. That has changed, too. But in the meantime, the women who you think, and I tend to agree with you, credibly accused him, had to live through decades of him being the most popular Democratic figure, if not the most popular politician in America. So hopefully things have changed.
Let's go to Tim in Amesbury. Hi, Tim.
Hey.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So, listen, I'm going to skip right over the sexual harassment issue and go right straight to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
I think that an individual would have to be deaf, dumb, blind, or incredibly ill-informed to not recognize the Republican Party and just about everybody in it as totally morally bankrupt. Hypocritical, whatever else you want to add to that, we have a large group of people, like I said, there may be a couple of exceptions, who are completely out of it. They have no moral foundation whatsoever. I mean, they just are in the process of executing a $1.5 million theft from the Treasury of the United States.
Trillion, $1.5 trillion, yeah.
These thieves in suits, real thieves, the thieves in suits down in New York City have more morals than these guys in their Armani suits in the halls.
Tim, are you just as critical of the Democrats for letting Conyers decide when he felt it was appropriate?
I am with you, Jim.
Good.
I am with you 100%. I lost my respect for Bill Clinton the day I found out that he had oral sex with somebody in the White House. I said, I thought the guy was smart, and I thought he was the smartest politician in America, and I lost every bit of respect for him, and I held my nose when I voted for his wife.
Tim, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
That's one of the things you think would be interesting in the history books of how much we always talked about how Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were the two most disliked people ever to run for office, and how much of the Hillary Clinton animus was driven by the whole history and the whole baggage of their marriage, their troubles, Bill Clinton's awful shenanigans and all that kind of stuff. And how the night that, remember the debate when Trump brought in the women that accused Bill Clinton,
oh,
Paula
yes,
Jones and Juanita Broderick and stuff like that.
Yep.
And you know, in a way it's analogous to how Ted Kennedy basically had to have a bag over his head at the Anita Hill hearings because he just come from this bacchanalia down in
Palm Beach, where he was
out drinking with his son and his nephew.
Can you refresh my recollection? I wasn't there. I know you were. He was silent until the end, was he not?
He was silent. He sat there and said nothing until Clarence Thomas called the hearings a high-tech
lynching.
And then Kennedy gave his very impassioned attack on Thomas, saying, "Don't you dare basically call this a high-tech lynching." He was silenced because his nephew was tried for rape in Palm Beach and was acquitted, even though, once again, and this is so often the case, there were several other women who had the exact same experience
just
as William
Kennedy
Smith.
Just like the Clarence Thomas thing, and they weren't allowed to testify.
But they weren't allowed to testify. Now, in a trial, you can say that's too prejudicial, mm-hmm. But it wouldn't have been, the Anita Hill hearing was not a formal trial. Those women could have testified. And I think Joe Biden and all the members of that committee have a lot to answer for why they didn't let those women testify.
Let's squeeze a couple more in. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the change, I guess you could say. Donald Trump, full endorsement of Roy Moore, RNC sending its money down after saying no more money 3 weeks ago, and Mitch McConnell doing a total flip-flop. Stephen Taunton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hey.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Why never any mention of Bob Menendez from New Jersey, the Democrat child molester?
Well, these are the underage.
Oh,
I can tell you why. You're talking about him allegedly cavorting with underage hookers, right?
That's right.
Last I read of it, and you may have read something more recent, prosecutors didn't move on that. That was a couple of years ago, though, charges were. And I don't, whether, I mean, he was charged and he just had his trial on that corruption issue. But I don't think there were ever charges pressed on the prostitutes, were they, or were they?
Yes, that was part of it. And he's under investigation by the Senate. And he's never mentioned in the litany of Kanye's and the senator from Minnesota or Moore. He's never mentioned.
Well, Steve, in all fairness, I don't think your facts are right. If they are, we're going to check them right now. He should absolutely be included in the list, but I don't think you have the latest on that. But again, if you are right, we'll correct ourselves in a couple of minutes, and we will include him on the list.
I've forgotten about the underage hookers.
That was a couple of years ago, but Steve says the Senate's looking at it still.
Yeah,
I don't know that
and
to be the case.
We should have remembered that, but
Steve, thanks
remember that.
For the call.
Meanwhile, Linda says the GOP now stands for the Grand Old Predators.
Well, you know, really, you know, the thing you said before, if I was a, I think Mitt Romney said it most perfectly.
You know, I love Mitt Romney. I mean, Mitt Romney has been kind of the conscience of the Republican Party. Not that it's done him any good, because he gave that impassioned speech about Donald Trump and was ridiculed. Then he did.
So why was he willing to be a Secretary of State?
Well, you know, I like to think it was partly the reason General McMaster is serving the President of the United States.
Maybe you're right.
When the President calls you, says you want to become Secretary of State, Mitt Romney would have probably been an excellent Secretary of State. We might not be in the situation we're in now
with
looking at nuclear war in North Korea if you had Mitt Romney there. So he may have just swallowed his pride and said, I'm going to go serve my country. But I love him for the fact that he's standing up. And Orrin Hatch, who was a disgrace in the Anita Hill hearings, is now disgracing himself on Roy Moore.
Well, but Orrin Hatch is only 84, so there's no reason he should think about not running for re-election.
And back in the day, for Orrin Hatch, it was anything goes. You know, it's like that guy that says that in the 70s. Who was the insurance guy that said in the 70s they would have beauty contests, best-looking broad in the office, and everybody had to parade around and get voted on? Oh, yeah. It was a guy that was used to run a health insurance company here in Massachusetts. So
we only have time for squeezing one more quick one. Bill and Newton, you're going to finish this part of our discussion on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I got a question for you.
Sure.
If one were a Republican Alabaman, and couldn't stomach voting for Roy Moore, but couldn't vote for a Democrat, does that person have a right to write in his vote? I don't know.
Yes, there is a write-in.
I think there's two write-ins. I could be mistaken, but I know there's at least one write-in. There may be two write-ins.
Well, my question to you folks is, I don't have no one. Does everybody in this country have a right to write in a vote for a senator, whether it's California or Maine?
I believe it's different states. But I do know that you can in Alabama. And the only reason I know, Bill, and thank you for your call, is because people were talking about what would happen should more listen to what was said about when people said he should pull out of the race, where the Republicans left with nothing because it was too late to get a new candidate. And the answer is they could write in Jeff Sessions, they could write in whatever they want. So Alabama, it's permitted. You have an update on Menendez, yes?
Yes, our staff just looked this up and said the Washington Post reported anonymous tipster told the press and the FBI in 2012 that Menendez paid for underage prostitutes in the Dominican Republic, but the allegations did not pan out.
So that, Steve, is the latest we know. If you know something more than we do, please let us know. Thanks for your calls.
Okay, coming up, it is a tax explainer. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber is here to break down what it means for the 1% and what it means for all the rest of us. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The tax plan passed in the Senate, 51-49, late Friday night, is a sprawling piece of legislation that could fundamentally change our society and way of life, not just on the tax front, but from education to the environment to infrastructure to healthcare. Make things worse for the poor, it will benefit the wealthy, that's a given. But what does that mean in practical terms for you and me? Joining us for another episode of Ask Me Anything, the GOP tax plan edition, is Jonathan Gruber. John's the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT. He was instrumental in designing RomneyCare and the Affordable Care Act. John Gruber, nice to see you.
Good to be here.
So, John, just bring us up to current events. Now the Senate and the House are together, and they're going to try to reach an agreement on the disparate plans.
Right. So you've got two plans that on their basic outline are similar. The core provision is to cut the corporate tax rate to 20%. There's a lot of differences. For instance, the Senate plan would pay for part of its changes by getting rid of the individual mandate. That's not in the House plan. The House plan would tax wealthy universities on their endowments. That's not in the Senate plan. There's a lot of moving pieces, but by and large, they're pretty close.
And by the way, I'm not glad you said that, but that's the reality. So those in the media trying to create drama are creating false drama. The reality is they are going to resolve their differences, and Trump's going to meet his goal of probably signing this thing before Christmas. Is that not a fair statement?
Well, it's not a done deal. Remember, I was feeling pretty cocky Christmas Eve 2009 when the Senate passed the Affordable Care Act, not realizing Scott Brown was going to win the special election. There's a special election in Alabama. There are some things. So, for example, I just found out today that, you know, I don't know if you saw the Senate bill, but they made all of like handwritten changes at the last minute.
Of course we saw it.
One handwritten change is to raise money. They put back in the alternative minimum tax for corporations, which they're going to get rid of. But the problem is, having cut the corporate tax rate, that alternative minimum tax now hits a ton of corporations. The corporations aren't happy about that. So there's things they want to change. So I think, Jim, the odds are high that it passes, but it is not a done deal.
And without getting totally lost in the weeds, the president's initial position when this all started was, I want the corporate tax rate in the high teens. And then he said 20 was fine, which is what it is in the bills. And he has now said over the weekend, I can live with 22. And the reason, I assume, is because by allowing the rate to be a little bit higher, that pulls in billions of dollars that some people who want, like Marco Rubio, more for a child tax credit can get theirs. Some that are upset that the alternative minimum tax, which actually hits the wealthy in the Senate for individuals, not just corporations, is a problem. It gives them more money to spread around. Is that not what's going on?
That's exactly right. That basically the question is how strong they feel about 20 versus some higher rate and how they want to spread the money around. But the bigger, the fundamental issue here is that in the Senate bill, all the individual tax provisions expire.
Yeah.
They don't in the House bill. So let's be clear for everyone on the radio what's happening here. This is a permanent tax cut for corporations, paid for by a temporary tax cut, followed by a permanent tax increase on individuals.
Right.
Okay. And by the way, they need to do that for I'm not defending it, but they would. The reason we're doing that, of course, they could have done it with corporations being temporary and the individuals being permanent, is because of their rule in the out years, this has to not have any impact on the deficit. Is that why they're doing this?
That's right, but let's be clear. The only reason that rule matters is because they wouldn't even talk to Democrats. Mm-hmm. There are some conservative Democrats in the Senate. Okay, they wouldn't even talk to Democrats about ways that they could have peeled a couple of them off to support this law. As a result, they have to pass with only 50 votes. And as a result, it has to be a law which raised the deficit by only, I'm doing air quotes here, $1.5 trillion in the first decade, and by zero in the second decade. And the way they're doing that is by having the individual tax cuts phase out and actually turn to tax increases. So many Americans will pay more in taxes as a result of this law, not less.
So you're an economist. Think of the most conservative economists you know. Would they be willing to put their hand on a Bible and say, I agree with Mitch McConnell, this thing is going to end up paying for itself?
There are no conservative economists who I know and even modestly respect who said that. Even the most conservative economists who recently said a letter, many of whom I know, supporting the tax cut, did not claim would pay for itself. No one claims it's going to pay for itself.
So most everyone except for Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have conceded that this is a massive kiss for the 1% and the richest people in America. Where can people that are in the middle class, say between, you know, 30,000 and 100,000 or 150,000, I don't know how you define the middle class anymore.
Everybody does it differently.
Okay, so where can people in the middle class be hopeful? I know people's 401ks have been going up, and lots of middle class people have 401ks.
I always think it's very important, Marjorie, to separate what the policy does from underlying things. There's lots of reasons to be hopeful for lots of things, but let's focus on the tax bill. Let's focus on what that does to the middle class.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, by the last year that this tax bill hits, so by 2025, you're talking about a tax increase on the bottom 20% and a tax cut on the order of 0.1% of their income for the middle of the income distribution. So it's a it's a tax increase in the bottom, a tiny tax cut in the middle.
So the poorest people
are
going to pay more.
And this is not counting the fact they're losing their health insurance. Ignoring the fact they're losing their health insurance, they're going to pay more. The middle class gets a small tax break, and the richest Americans see their incomes go up by, on average, 2%. So basically, which sounds like a small number, but at the end of the day, you're talking about tax cuts to the richest Americans, which are on the order of $100,000 a year to the top richest Americans, as opposed to about $500 a year for middle class.
John Gruber, I want to be clear about something, though, that while people like Larry Summers, is obviously former head of Harvard and former Secretary of the Treasury, are writing pieces saying things like 10,000 people will die a year because of the repeal of this mandate, even if the repeal of the mandate doesn't make it through this conference, the healthcare individual mandate doesn't make it through the conference and is eliminated, the conventional wisdom, and I want to know if you subscribe to this, is this is going to so tighten local budgets, particularly in blue states with high state and local taxes, which are going to have to rein them in because they're no longer deductible, that there are going to be backdoor ultimate cuts in things like Medicaid, for example, as a result of the configuration of this tax cut. Is that not so?
You don't have to conjecture that. You've already heard in this letter that there's 9 very conservative economists wrote and other conservative economists have been saying, they've been saying, let's do this tax cut. It's good for growth. And then let's deal with the deficit by cutting social programs. Mm-hmm. So it's not hidden. It's the agenda. Orrin Hatch stood up and said, we cannot afford the $14 billion we need to keep paying for health insurance for children at the same time as he supported a $1.5 trillion tax cut, 60% of which goes to the top 1% of Americans. The agenda is transparent. The question is, will the American voter put up with it? Republicans seem to think they will by saying, oh, don't worry, it's a big tax cut. Everyone gets a tax cut. The question is, at the end of the day, if a middle-class American is getting $500, but as a result his Medicare is going to get cut, his health insurance is going to get cut, his Medicaid is going to get cut, does the middle-class American set up and say, wait a second, this was a bad deal?
Well, you know, speaking of middle-class Americans, I historically, I hope this doesn't upset that emailer before, very conservative Republicans, with some exceptions, have not been wild supporters of what they like to call entitlement programs. But let's talk about something that the middle class benefits from, education. try to rationalize for me. We talked to Paul Revel the other day, former Secretary of Education, talking about the education impacts in this bill, and most people can recite them. The end of the deductibility of your student loans, what was it, $2,500? Teachers can't deduct the $250 out of pocket for expenses. Graduate teaching assistants are going to have their quote wages, and I use air quotes there, taxed. Endowments, which in many cases help subsidize low-income students, money from the endowments. I mean, across the board, this is an assault on education. How does that fulfill a Republican dream? Again, I understand the cuts on poor people because they should all go back to work and be productive. They shouldn't depend on us, the argument goes. I mean, that is what the but how do they defend what is obviously going to happen to education?
Look, I don't know. I mean, basically, you know, I wrote an editorial about sort of all the anti-growth features of this law. I mean, they're supposed to be a pro-growth party,
right,
but they're doing all the things you said. They're cutting back corporate tax breaks for research and development. So much as they give new tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans, they're reducing the benefits corporations get from doing research and development, which is the engine of our growth. At the end of the day, they are appealing to the fact that right now, among Republican voters, higher education is not popular. 58% of Republicans think universities are bad for America.
Okay. Because of their liberal politics. Is that where it comes from?
For various reasons.
So,
but the bottom line is Republicans are appealing to those voters, not trying to do what's good for the country.
We didn't see your piece about what this does to growth. What's the argument you make?
Well, basically the argument we make as economists is the engine of growth is productivity. And the engine of productivity in our economy is knowledge. And the way you make knowledge is by educating people, especially graduate students who can go on and invent the technologies of the future here in the U.S. Look, if we don't invent them, they're going to get invented just in other countries. It's slowing growth because it's limiting the ability of companies to get a tax break for the research and development. And ultimately, a huge increase in the deficit slows growth by raising interest rates and making companies less willing to invest in
research. Well, let's talk about that because I've seen many stories talking about a coming recession and huge interest rate increases. Is that hysterical or is that...
I think that's hysterical because I think that this by itself will not lead to huge interest rate increases. The point is, however, we have a long-run budget deficit problem.
Right.
And that something has to give. Either we have to spend less on entitlements or raise more in taxes. Something has to give over the next 20 years. And by taking this step towards making that deficit even bigger... Okay, it's essentially saying what Republicans want to give is a social safety net. The problem is Americans have shown they like that social safety net.
Yeah.
Remember, Obamacare repeal failed not because people liked the mandate, but because they liked Medicaid and they liked those subsidies. So the question is, who's going to be the adult in the room? Okay, Democrats tried to be the adult in the room. Bill Clinton built a surplus. George Bush wasted it. Obama came in and had took a crashing economy and a devastatingly huge deficit, cut it from 2% of GDP to 0.5% of GDP. Now Trump's wasting it again. The question is, when the Democrats come back in, are they going to continue to be willing to be the adults in the room? Or are they going to say, why do we keep playing by the rules when the other party breaks it? We're going to be fiscally responsible too. And then what happens?
We're talking to Jonathan Gruber, MIT economist, about the tax plan. I want to ask you, too, about health care because, of course, you were very much involved in the creation of Obamacare and in Romney Care here in Massachusetts. So what does it mean if they do prevail? It's the Senate that wants to get rid of the Obamacare mandate,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what will the impact of that be, just not on Obamacare, but on health care in general and the cost of health care to people who are not on Obamacare, like most of us are not?
Right. I mean, so most of the effects will be felt within Obamacare. So the main effects will be that many people who have insurance today will lose it. And the premiums in the Obamacare exchanges will rise significantly. However,
because the healthiest people are probably the ones who are going to say, I'm
exactly.
going to drop.
Okay. The healthiest people will drop out.
End. This could be the end of Obamacare.
It won't be the end because, remember, most people in the exchanges are subsidized.
Yep.
They just pay a fixed percent of income. What Trump is doing ironically, what this law does ironically, is it's the end of the part of Obamacare that wasn't a government program. Okay, it's turning Obamacare into a government entitlement because what's left, Medicaid's left. The tax subsidies to low-income people to buy insurance are left. All you're doing is getting rid of the people who are buying insurance on their own, the people who are voluntarily participating. They go because premiums get too high. There is another effect on all of us, though, which is when there's more uninsured, that's more uninsured people going to the hospital, that's more uncompensated care, and that's higher medical costs for all of us. One of the major accomplishments of the Affordable Care Act was reducing hospital and compensated care, which fell by almost half since the Affordable Care Act was passed. When that goes back up, that's higher hospital bills for the rest of us.
We're talking to Jonathan Gruber from MIT. You know, Jonathan, I know this is obvious, but I'll state the obvious anyway. Part of the problem here, Marjorie and I have fought back and forth since this tax thing started about how do you sell this credibly to the American people, and my contention has been as long as you convince the middle class they're getting something, they're not saying to themselves, well, the rich guys are getting a disproportionate share, I'll take mine. But it seems to me, and I'm wondering if you've ever done research on this, the ability of the average person to make the connection that having a tax cut, which creates a huge additional deficit, means down the line that they're going to have to be deep cuts in things that you care about, whether it's your local infrastructure, whether it's your schools, your healthcare, et cetera. That's a pretty great leap. I mean, for someone like you, obviously, they all are interconnected. But does the average person, even when they're told by the likes of the generic you, do they get that connection? Or sort of Ronald Reagan's brilliance to me was separating spending from taxation. You can cut taxation and not affect spending, even though it's not true. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, another way to put what you're saying is how do you get Americans to care about the deficit? Now, there is...
And the impact of the deficit on things they care about.
On things they care about. Now, there is one positive example in our history, which was Ross Perot, who ran for president, got 19% of the vote, and a lot of his campaign was based on reducing the deficit.
Yeah.
So we do have in our not-too-distant past someone who made a lot of political hay out of this issue. There's no one recently who's done it. The problem, Jim, is it's not a one-for-one connection. So when we make these cuts – now, it is true there actually is a partial one-for-one connection, which has not been emphasized enough, which is there's another law that Congress is running up against called the PAYGO law. And the PAYGO law says that – all tax cuts need to be paid for with offsetting spending cuts. This law violates PAYGO. So unless Congress suspends PAYGO, there's going to be automatic spending cuts, direct one for one. Medicare will be cut $25 billion because of this tax increase. Now, Republicans are saying, oh, don't worry about it. We'll cover that. We'll figure it out. I don't know why anybody trusts any promises they make right now. So let's be clear. There's a direct connection, Jim, which is not getting enough attention. This law will cut your Medicare by $25 billion, which is much more than the middle class tax cut.
And what does that mean? Does that mean it cuts what is covered under Medicare, or if you go to the hospital or your prescriptions? What does that mean?
It cuts what providers are reimbursed under Medicare,
okay,
which is going to lower your access, which is going to put more financial strain on hospitals. They'll be less able to deal with other groups as well.
And that would impact nursing homes as well?
Nursing homes are primarily Medicaid.
Okay,
it's
Medicaid.
Mostly be hospitals, okay, and doctors.
But, you know, it's one of these things. I'm hearkening back a couple months ago when you wrote that piece in the New York Times with a couple of your colleagues about, and I'll paraphrase, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, hey, for those of you who think Medicaid is just for those poor people over there who we should care about, but that's them. This is your mother at the nursing home.
Right.
This is you in the nursing home in 10 years or whatever it is. When the approach to selling so many things in politics is really the big lie, this is bad for me, says Donald Trump. My rich friends are really upset with me. I guess one has to believe it's working with enough of the population, including several hundred Republicans in Congress, that they're voting for something that even they should know is not what they're offering up.
Well, I mean, in some sense, it's a big test. It's in some sense one of the most important tests our democracy has faced, which is essentially they've decided they are going to try to lie their way to tax cuts for the rich. Not bend the truth, but break the truth. And the question is, will they pay at the polls? And many of them think they won't. Many of them think, look, our voters mostly watch Fox News, which is covering this as a big win, not covering the fact Medicare will be cut by $25 billion, and that this is confusing, and we're claiming it's good, and people listen to us. So it's a fundamental question of whether truth and facts matter in political debates anymore.
By the way, Chuck Todd from Meet the Press, who plays down the middle, told us last Thursday on this show, I think he used the word nightmare to describe what this tax bill is, in his estimation, is going to be for Republicans come 2018.
What about small businesses that we heard so much about? Are they getting the relief that they've been promised?
You mean this pass-through thing? Can you explain that
to
us?
Yeah, so basically, here's how it works. Most of the stuff we buy is from corporations. They're called C corporations, you know, General Motors, General Mills, etc. But most of the firms in the economy are not C corporations. They're what's called S corporations. They're basically they're partnerships. They're sole proprietorships. They're your dentist, your doctor, your lawyer, your auto dealer. That is a lot of what – that's most of the corporate – it's not most of the money, but it's most of the corporations. Mm-hmm. Those individuals, when they make money, pay the individual tax rate, not the corporate tax rate. Now, typically, those rates have been fairly similar, so it hasn't mattered. The problem is if you cut the corporate tax rate but leave the individual tax rate high, then suddenly those auto dealers, those doctors, those lawyers are saying, wait a second, corporations are paying lower rate. Why do I have to pay a higher rate? So they want to give a tax break to those folks too. The problem is that costs too much money. So how are they doing it? The way they're doing it is by saying, well, our tax break doesn't apply to lawyers. It doesn't apply to doctors. It just applies to guys who own small businesses. So the auto dealers get a break, but the lawyers and the doctors don't. It's a very strange way to do it, but it's sort of they're trying to essentially give a break to some small businesses, but a particularly strange set of them.
And how do they decide who gets and who doesn't?
Basically, this is terrific. You only get it if you have passive income. That if you're actually working to earn your money, you don't get a tax break. Active income, you don't get a tax break. Passive income, which is the income you just make from owning a business, then you get a tax
break.
So
Donald Trump, the New York Times reporter a few weeks ago, owns 500 of those. I assume that's passive income.
That's passive income. But let's be clear. This is the party of work and individual responsibility. And they are saying, if you work as a small business, we're not going to give you a tax break. But if you own a small business and it's passive, then you get the tax break. I mean, this is a nightmare. And it's a horrible piece of policy. And along so many dimensions, it's hard to cover them in 20 minutes, let alone an hour.
You know, one quick thing. I hear all the time people say about the estate tax. Well, I have no problem with the estate tax, even though it's for wealthy people, because why should money be taxed twice? And I'm thinking, well, it's not taxed twice by the children that inherit the money. It's only taxed
Let's
by
be clear. So there's two problems with that argument.
Yep.
First of all, what about when you buy something at CVS? You pay a sales tax, you're taxed twice then. Why do we want to get rid of the estate tax, which applies to the 4,000 wealthiest families every year, yet raises $20 billion, but we're fine with paying twice when we go to CVS to buy something?
How are we paying twice at CVS?
Because your income is taxed.
Your income's taxed,
and you're paying sales tax. Okay.
It's the same thing. The second of all is you're not taxed twice with the estate tax, and here's why. Because most income for the wealthiest in the form of capital gains, and capital gains are not taxed when you die except for the estate tax. So let's be clear. If we get rid of the estate tax, as Republicans want to do, then if I bought a painting for $100 and it's worth $1 million when I die, then that million is totally untaxed.
By the way, a lot of you may be frustrated because you wanted to ask Jonathan Gruber questions, but we did too. We promise you we'll have Act Two of Gruber answering all your tax questions before Christmas, Jonathan. Thanks for agreeing to that.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Gruber. John is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT. He was instrumental in creating both Romney Care and the Affordable Care Act, and he is a BPR contributor.
Well, he is actually like a computer
sort
in
of
many
is.
Ways.
Thank
really
you very much, John.
Thank you.
Up
See
next,
you, John.
When a man turned up in the ER with a do not resuscitate order, what happened? Our medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for that and more. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting from the Boston Public Library.
At noon from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, we're joined by medical ethicist Art Kaplan on the CVS purchase of Aetna and what it'll mean for healthcare. And can't afford a real shrink? Well, have we got a robot for you?
We will open the lines and ask you about the robots Jim just mentioned. What are they? Robot shrinks. Could you go for one? Imagine. You won't have to worry about your therapist judging you anymore. Corby Cummer, our food man, asks if becoming a chef is bad for your health. Plus, London bans fast food joints next to city schools and very fancy dining for your pets, Corby will explain. Gun control activist John Rosenthal sends lawmakers graphic images of gun violence victims. He joins us here at the library. And Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane puts the GOP tax plan in the context of history. More than 50 years of tax reform. Are we better off or worse? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It is Tuesday. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. So it's winter kind of thing, but let's not talk about it.
Okay.
So with the Aetna deal, CVS is aiming to turn its pharmacies into healthcare hubs. No doubt CVS will have a better selection of magazines in the doctor's office, but what about the quality of care? And if you feel iffy about CVS entering the healthcare industry, is it worse when doctors are in the business of piercing kids' ears and charging a whopping $1,800 for their services? Join us online for his take on these and other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art is the doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art Kaplan.
How are you? That introduction seems to be getting longer. You'll have to add in the honorary captaincy in the Bulgarian Navy pretty soon.
I actually had that. Marjorie cut it off. We'll do it next week.
So, Art Kaplan, since I spent half of my life at CVS already, gotten flu shots there, had the kids check for strep throats, and it's much better than being in the emergency room for 6 hours all night long, or not to mention ear infections with babies, is this a good thing or not a good thing?
Mixed. I think CVS and other big sort of pharmacy chains are going to get more and more in the business of delivering primary health care services. Like you said, Marjorie, you already get a ton of flu shots given out in that setting. I see they're adding in other kinds of shots and vaccines in many of these CVS too. And pretty soon, I think, there'll be a nurse there who will monitor your blood pressure or maybe for diabetes, keep track of your sugar levels in your bloodstream, that sort of thing. And I think that's okay, as long as everybody is, you know, qualified and so forth. That sounds like an easier way to get primary care for a lot of people. Whether it turns out to be cheaper, we'll have to see. But at least it's less waiting and certainly better than the emergency room. Don't want to be doing that sort of stuff there. Downsides. When you merge in with a big insurance company, boy, it's the end of privacy. I mean, they know what you're doing on the insurance side. Now CVS will know what you're doing in terms of prescriptions and when you visit them. And they're just going to have your health info. And so you can look forward to a lot of hectoring emails and pestering phone calls and say, get in. You know, I don't know about you, Marjorie, but they're already calling me every 5 minutes to come get a prescription that they filled.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's going to be a lot more of that because now they'll be watching your insurance record as well. And that's just a gigantic database, by the way, fraught with hacking and leaking, inadvertent leaking and accident possibilities about sensitive health information. I think the other issue is, so if these big insurance companies own CVS, are they going to start sort of underwriting you and saying, you know, you're not compliant. Marjorie never does come in and fill her prescriptions. She misses 10% of them. I don't think that's a person we want to insure anymore. So you start seeing issues around what they use to underwrite your insurance because they now know what you're doing at the CVS in terms of whether you're going to get your care. So it's a mixed bag. The march toward it is pretty inevitable.
Well, also, can I go back to your first thing? I live in a neighborhood where there are two urgent care clinics within a block and a half of my house, which really changes everything in terms of access to care. Obviously, we care about quality too. But what are there 9,000 CVSs around the country? Aetna is one of the biggest healthcare providers. So while I have worries about,
I think I saw a number that said 70% of Americans live within a mile of one.
So, yeah, well, that's amazing. But
yeah.
But my point is that while all the potential downsides are ones that hopefully both regulators aren't going to care about them anymore, but people like you will worry about and police as best you can, the fact that there's going to be such incredible access, it's already happening, is a huge step in the right direction, right?
Right. I mean, I think there are simple, basic health prevention and health monitoring things that can be done. Get the right nurse staffing, the CVS equivalent of the Urgy Clinic or the whatever they call them in the stores, and you'll get more access that way. In some sense, medicine has failed the American people because it's got too many specialists and not enough generalists. And we can argue about why that is, but it just is. And you're going to have more nurses and physician assistants out there. They're going to have to be the person power to deliver this care. And I think the CVS setting, you know, it's as good as any other.
You know, I just want to be clear on what this one thing. Does all the snooping into what you're doing is if you're insured through Aetna or if you're insured through anybody? Does this mean if you have Tufts or Blue Cross?
Electronic
or,
medical records. So, it's a new age, right?
For this one, it would be Aetna.
It would be Aetna, okay.
So and then eventually it'll be everybody.
Okay.
All right. All the records together.
You know, one last thing about this. You know, I realized I actually use a Walgreens, not a CVS. But so when I was walking around Walgreens in a Johnny with the back open the other night, that was that was premature. Is that what you're saying?
It was premature, and you should not let the kid behind the counter do your tonsillectomy.
Okay, yeah. Fine. Let's leave it at that.
All I can think
Thank
about is
much.
Having to be all night in emergency rooms for earaches because your doctor's office is closed. And it's just when your children are little, it's a real big savings, it seems to me. But anyway, let's move on to another reason why you had to be wary of hospitals. Tell us about this mother in Colorado who thought she was getting just a little special something extra from the surgeon when he offered to pierce her daughter's ear. This is incredible.
I don't remember the price. What was it,
$1,877.
Yeah.
So here's a lesson. Before you say yes, ask, what's that going to cost? So remember, these are completely non-covered, non-necessary medical interventions. The doctors are happy to do them, but you're going to pay full price, as much as they can charge, because it's an elective, optional, not necessary thing. No insurance is going to cover it. How they got up to that price, I have no idea. I literally can't imagine. I think, weren't there people piercing ears in jewelry stores and
yes,
stuff?
For free, $5 Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, what I don't understand is how the heck the surgeon offered to do this without telling her it was going to cost her money. It seemed to be a total...
Well, when does your doctor tell you how much of anything
usually,
is going to cost?
Usually your surgeon isn't saying, hey, while you're here, I'll give you a haircut. Or while you're here, I'll pierce your ear. You know, this is... You're there for medical...
It's the old barber surgeon.
Yeah, exactly. So
haircut and a gallbladder.
But it seems like she had to fight tooth and nail to get the hospital to lower the cost of her...
Did they ever, or did she lose this one? I thought that they...
I think they're still fighting about it.
You know, Art, but...
So, my lesson is, consumer, beware, always ask if it's some kind of an elective thing. I don't care if you ask about whether the price is on anything, but certainly if you're going to get an elective procedure... Here's the other ethics question. Do five-year-olds need pierced ears?
Yeah, but I think you see a lot of people with very young children.
Very young children.
I think it's also a cultural thing, too, that some people pierce their ears really young.
But can we get away from the ear piercing for a second to the larger question, which this folds into, is the massive amount of wasteful healthcare spending. And they're estimating somewhere in the, you know, a quarter of all spending, $750 billion. I told you the story last year, I think. I had Don Berwick on my television show, the former head of Medicare and Medicaid. And I was remarking about some recent study on healthcare wasteful spending, and I said, I can't believe I didn't know about this. Did you know about it? I said to Berwick, and he said something like, you mean when I wrote the report on this 15 years ago? So is progress being made on this front?
No.
This is a colossal amount. Why?
Too much money being made, no real incentive to try and do anything about it. Remember, the customer or the patient often doesn't see the cost. It just gets buried in some third-party thing. I think the insurer's attitude is, you want ear piercing coverage? Sure, we'll raise your premium. You can have whatever you want. Right. We'll add that in. So I don't see any, again, I think of it as a failure of the market. There's nobody sort of watching the price, and there's no pressure to drive it down.
You know, by the way, Colorado Children's Hospital was going to make this woman pay the full $1,877 until the media, in the form of ProPublica, inquired about the bill. And then suddenly the hospital canceled the remaining balance. But let's move on to something else that I think is a really fascinating story. A man who was dying of, I believe it was cancer, had terrible cataracts, and he wanted to be able to see his family in the few weeks he had left before he died. Talk about a medical ethicist. Mm-hmm. Great one. What do you think, Art Kaplan?
So this guy was developing these cataracts. I believe it was within the past year or two. He definitely had a terminal illness. He had a wish, which was to be able to see his family before he died. And the ophthalmologist, the eye doctor, said, gee, I don't know if it's worth removing your cataracts. That's expensive. You're not going to get that much use out of your eyes because you're going to die. I'm not sure we should do this. To which I would say, are you crazy? This is a major quality of life enhancement. It's part of what I would call palliative care,
yep.
You know, making somebody comfortable at the end of life. It's always good to be able to see not only your family, but the menu or whether a tube is falling out of your body or television or many other things that sight helps us do. So to me, it's open and shut. You ought to be doing this procedure. Cataract surgery isn't that expensive. It's not crazy expensive. So I can't even believe that cost was tossed up as an issue on this one. It's such a benefit to have your sight.
But you're raising the cost issue too. I mean, I looked it up and it said cataract surgery on average costs $3,000. It's done very quickly. I'm with you on this, but let's assume it was $103,000, and the man said the same thing. And by the way, he ultimately died a few weeks later.
Yeah.
I want to be able to drive again. I want to be able to see my family again. All of which I think is hugely important. But instead of a few $1,000s, it was a ton of money. How do you decide as an ethicist? Where's the line on the financial spectrum? I assume there is one, isn't there?
A ton of money to keep you in bed, nauseated, unable to eat anything, unable to do anything except lie there.
Mm-hmm.
There are some drugs that can extend your life for a lot of money in that manner, and I think that's an argument as to whether that's worthwhile. A really just simple life extension when, let's say, you're nearly comatose or you're miserable, I can imagine people saying that's just not worth doing to get another month.
Mm-hmm.
It's just crazy. But on the flip side, restoring sight as part of the quality of life that somebody could enjoy, that's major. So I would spend $100,000, not just three. It seems to me you'd cut the cost of having to have an aide or someone to take you around or someone to toilet you. And all. I mean, you can sort of make the case that sight restoration for anybody who's hospitalized and is going to be spending time, let's say, in a nursing home or someplace like that, boy, you'd still come out ahead. So to me, that one's cost-effective for sure.
Well, you know what? I'm so glad you said that, Art Kaplan, because this piece talks about the fact that a third of Medicare dollars is spent in the last years of a patient's life. And we do go, and you hear these stories all the time about the children are fighting. Do we let Dad go? Do we not let Dad go? No, we're not going to let Dad go. And we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars keeping Dad in practically a vegetative state. So this is like talking about not just prolonging life. And as you say, when someone's in a coma and they're practically out of it completely and improving life, and they talk about how this guy got to go to a family reunion in the last weeks of his life. He was able to drive himself around. Mm-hmm. It just seems that our focus is on the wrong thing, that because we can't make up our mind when enough is enough. You know, we don't want to
I agree with that. And I think if you ask dying people, would you rather have another month of life miserable?
Yeah.
Would you rather have somebody pay for your hearing aid to make sure that it works? A lot of them would say, you know, even if I didn't get that extra month of life, I'd like to be able to hear while I'm dying so I can, you know, quality of life is important. And that has to weigh into these decisions. We just don't like to get into it because, as Jim started to say, you know, where's the line and how do you do it? But there are definitely miserable conditions that I think very few people would pick as a state to be in if they couldn't see, hear, move, eat, ambulate, do anything, be responsive. That's, believe it or not, the place where we get into a lot of arguments about should we let Dad go. I think the answer is it's pretty clear that Dad probably wouldn't want to be that way, nor would you. But on the other hand, finding ways to let people eat or hear or see, those are pretty valuable to people in terms of quality of life. So
you know,
I don't think
it's amazing.
We value quality of life enough, to put it simply.
You know, I am perfectly healthy, and my two daughters were having the exact same conversation tonight. Should we let Dad go? So I don't know. I really don't know. But to yeah. make
was
it
there something that triggered that?
Yeah, they read about
I'm
these
not quite
state
sure.
tax. Figured take advantage of it fast.
Well, you can. Yeah. We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist from NYU.
So this is a great story. I did not know that,
Neither did I.
Women are sometimes born without a uterus, but apparently they are. And now for the first time, a woman with a transplanted uterus gave birth.
It just happened at Baylor. Baby seems to be okay. Interesting. This now this gets us right into the quality of life.
Right.
Very smart, Marjorie. You went right to a quality of life case
yeah.
right after that discussion. Because, remember, the woman doesn't have a uterus, but she is only getting a transplant and carrying the baby for the experience of carrying the baby during
yep.
pregnancy. It's solely quality of life because you could look for a surrogate mother,
yep.
right? You don't have to do it yourself or ask a sister or somebody to carry your baby if you wanted to. And a lot of people do that. I know that surrogacy is illegal in some states, but people go to other states and kind of hire the surrogate. So this procedure is done solely to give you that experience. But here's a problem. Because of the way the uterus has to be taken out and reconnected, you don't get the nerves. You get the belly and you get sort of the weight, but you don't get the sensation from the fetus inside
oh.
you.
Oh.
So it's kind of carrying the baby, but not the same way it would be in a normal pregnancy. And just so listeners know, you put the uterus in, it has the baby in there, but then you have to have a C-section because it's too much force. It would damage the uterus and tear it apart. So you have to C-section out the baby, and then you have to remove the uterus. It's kind of a one use only, and you don't want to keep giving somebody immunosuppressive drugs. So this thing is a miracle in a way, but it's also complicated because you're spending a lot of money to have a partial experience. It's a quality of life procedure.
Okay, so medical ethicist, do you think this is something we should be spending money on? Because part of the whole thing about carrying a baby is feeling the baby.
Yeah, I wouldn't cover it by insurance. Yeah. Would I ban it? No. If people want to pay for it, I think that's okay. But I'm not sure this procedure is one when there are options
yeah.
that you really have to sort of drive forward. And I'm not sure there's going to be a big market for it, to tell you the truth.
Because you can
kind of understand the limits of uterine transplant, they may wind up saying, you know, maybe we'll use a gestational mom.
Because you could also have your own egg. If mom didn't have a uterus, she could use her own eggs and her
Correct.
Husband's sperm, and they could have their biological child, but she just would not carry it.
Correct. And, you know, you can sometimes find a family member to help you for free. I mean, that does happen. We have volunteers who carry children for their sister. I've seen moms do it for their daughters.
Yep.
Not common, but I've seen it. And so, you know, you got to pay for the immunosuppression for this procedure, which
yeah.
is limited because the thing's only in there 9 months or 8 months. But it's not cheap. Not cheap.
You know, Art Kaplan, I want to touch on this next thing quickly because I have my appointment with my Wobot soon, and I really want to get to that. You know, this story, everywhere I go on the internet, people are talking about this thing. It was out of the New England Journal of Medicine about this guy, I think he was 70 years old, who had a tattoo, DNR, and the implication was do not resuscitate. And I am stunned.
The whole words were across.
I am stunned mm-hmm. that there's such mm-hmm. a big debate about this. The notion being that doctors, medical professionals should decide to not resuscitate because of a tattoo without any supporting documentation. I don't get this at all. Am I missing something or no?
You're missing the tattoo part.
Well, apparently I am.
So people are saying, look, for a long time people have worn bracelets. A few people have had medical directives tattooed on themselves to say, don't resuscitate me. They mean it. Who's going to get that? DNR is not exactly, you know, rosy. You're not tattooing yourself with some sort of design or military insignia or your favorite boyfriend or girlfriend or something. Of course they mean it. Why aren't you paying attention to the fact that they went so far as to put that order right on them? So that's the strong argument. On the other hand, I'm with you. I mean, I think you got to have an advance directive. Write down your wishes. Put them on a piece of paper, have some people witness it,
exactly.
date it, update it
on
periodically.
On your state of mind, exactly. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And then put that in your wallet or your pocketbook and have that with you, too. You can tattoo yourself, that's great, but that's a trigger to saying, you know, let's check and see what's up. Let's talk to his family. Let's talk to his friends. Let's see if we can find some sort of written statement. Tattoos, you know, look, let's face it. They're not legally binding. They're kind of body art. They're not the same as you could put your will on your body, too, I guess. You know, you could write down, I'm leaving my money, but never to Jim.
Yeah.
Just so you know, it's right here on my arm. But I don't think that's the way to go long term. No.
You just have to think about someone who goes to the tattoo artist and says, I want to have big letters, do not resuscitate, put across my chest. It's an unusual sort
of
thing.
Yeah, but how do you know they're not, like, smoking dope when they're doing it?
Well, they could be smoking dope. It's just an odd kind of
thing.
What
odd.
Does it say about your psyche? I'm not worth resuscitating,
okay,
or it's a joke, or
you know what they should do if they do that,
Jim?
As far as I'm concerned? They should go see a Wobot. Now, I had never heard of Wobots before, and as I'm sure Marjorie will tell
you. Hey, by the way, I do a little public service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No public service. Tattoos are no substitute for having that awful conversation with your family
Correct.
Members about what you want. So
That's
have
right.
it. Doesn't matter if you tattoo yourself up and down, you make sleeves of DNR orders on your arms.
Okay.
Still got to have that conversation.
Okay, so can you describe to people, for $39 a month after a two-week free trial, if you can't afford a regular shrink, you can go see a Wobot, and amazingly, there is apparently incredibly high satisfaction rates with these robotic shrinks, therapists kind of thing. Can you describe it and tell us what your position is on this?
No, I
Thank
cannot.
You. Okay, so I will describe it. It's essentially you have this machine who provides mental health care for you, in great part because I don't know if you saw the Kaiser Family Foundation study, Art Kaplan, that more than 100 million people, that's roughly a third of the country, live in areas that are federally designated as having a shortage of mental health care professionals. So instead, you go to a Wobot. And here's some of the comments, Art. I think these will impress you. These are Wobot users. I love Wobot so much. I hope we can be friends forever. I actually feel super good and happy when I see it remembered, in quotes, to check in with me. Next one, Wobot is a fun little dude, and I hope he keeps improving. On and on. A lot of people, apparently, there are 2 million conversations a week already going on, apparently. So what's your take on the Wobot as opposed
you
to...
You left out the most important
what
part.
I missed that. What is it?
Because and some of us know people who spent many, many years in therapy, but they don't really want to be straight with their therapist about what's going on in their life because they're too worried about being embarrassed and humiliated. And Jim confessed that this morning, but if you went to a Wobot, he wouldn't have to worry.
Why would you ever tell your shrink the truth? It's ridiculous.
Exactly.
So what's your take on this? It's affordable. It doesn't talk back. I'm serious.
But by the way, you know, this is not a new idea. There was
a
program years ago you just put in your computer that I think had 6 responses. That's okay. Please go on. I think you're not telling me the truth. And I think they were random, and people love that.
But these are not random. This is like an AI kind of experience here.
No, I understand. I understand. But my point being, it doesn't take a lot to give people some relief of mental anxiety, mental health issues. Sometimes you just need a responsive chime or something. So I'm not hugely shocked. On the other hand, the Wobots aren't really there yet to pick up who's got suicidal impulses
That's
and all the rest of it. It's kind of a charming thing that's fun right now if you want to, amuse yourself and see if it's a little bit like talking to Siri. Remember the movie where the guy fell in love with Siri?
Yeah,
I love that movie.
You know, we're kind of dopey creatures. We can be misled into affective relationships with a rock if we think the rock is looking at us in a nice way. So,
but on a serious note, can you not see how some people might find this of use? Yes or no?
I see how they find it of use. I don't trust it yet. Do I think the future is to have some sort of robot-programmed algorithm to help counsel people? Yeah, I do. I just don't think I think these things are toys, that's all.
Remember when the guy in Siri took the computer away for a romantic weekend
I
to
do.
The cabin in the woods?
Scarlett Johansson. Wasn't that who it was?
It was unbelievable.
That was the voice, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the voice,
Scarlett Johansson. Yeah, it was great. So, Art Kaplan, what is on the Everyday Ethics podcast, please?
Better be Wobot if you know what you're doing there. Go ahead.
I'm going to be outed as a Wobot. It's all been mechanical all these many years. There's no ethicist there at all.
What's on the podcast?
So what we're going to talk about is an interesting phenomenon in ethics called akrasia.
What is that?
Weakness of will. Why is it that people can't do the right thing even though they know what the right thing is to do? You're not going to convince me that all the sexual harassment stuff people needed an ethics lesson, right?
Uh-huh.
They just decided, I'm powerful, I'll do it. Or, to take it down to mundane levels, I watch football. I think football is immoral. There was a guy who just got a spinal cord injury that was serious pro football game. The injuries are horrendous. The concussions are brutal. But somehow I find myself still watching, and that's weakness of will. I know it's wrong. I don't believe it's the right thing to do. Why can't I do it? Why can't I get myself to do the right thing?
Oh, this is a great one.
What's the word one more time? We're going to listen. But
Akrasia, A-K-R-A,
great.
Like Asia.
Great. Hey, Art, pleasure as always. Thanks so much for your time.
Art Kaplan, thank you very much. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Doctors William F. and Virginia Conley Mitty Chair, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, and the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Coming up, goodbye, Alpo. Hello, artisanal. Is Fido becoming a foodie? Corby Kummer joins us to talk about the latest advances in pet food. He joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. British Parliament recently debated if Donald Trump should be banned from the UK. But is there really a distinction between banning him and banning fast food franchises? London's mayor is working to block the likes of McDonald's, and it just might help to keep the Donald away, too. Joining us for his take on this, the mental health hazards of being a chef, and other headlines about food policy and food culture, is Corby Kummer. Corby's an award-winning food writer, restaurant critic, senior editor at The Atlantic, and columnist for The New Republic. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello there.
So, Corby Kummer, this is an amazing story. I mean, no more McDonald's and Pizza Huts and Burger Kings, whatever else they got in London. They don't want them near schools anymore.
Love this.
So because our president's main diet is McDonald's and fast food, if it takes banning them to get the president not to come to your country, it will have been worth it. And it could have a big beneficial side effect of improving childhood obesity. Because as we know, and we talk about on this show a lot, 1 in 5 children aged 11 is obese in both the United Kingdom and this country. So what to do about it? For a long time, there's been a theory based on a 2009 study that if you ban fast food outlets within, I don't know how
is
many
feet.
Is it a mile or walking distance?
It's even better.
Of a fast food outlet, you will decrease the likelihood that kids will go out at recess, go out at lunch, and just nip over and get their chips and burger, which is what happens.
Has anybody else done this in any major city besides?
Los Angeles tried it, and it didn't work.
What is that? What, a challenge in a court or something? What do you mean it didn't work?
No, Los Angeles tried it, and then they stopped doing it. There was a blanket ban on new standalone restaurants, so it was new ones. And then this was in 2008, and after 7 years, there was a study saying that the ordinance hadn't improved childhood obesity, but it was mostly because they weren't banning the pre-existing ones. So it was only the new ones, and of course that was unfair competition. The idea is ban them all, which is what London wants to do.
Well, they want to ban them all within a certain proximity to schools, which is where you got to hopefully help these kids.
I wonder if their lunches are any more healthy than our lunches here.
What are you talking about?
Great Britain.
You mean in schools?
Yeah, because you've been trying to make them more healthy.
Well, they've had Jamie Oliver starting national campaigns to try to improve school lunch. It was there that a mother who was a publicity hound slipped her child fish and chips like through an anchor chain fence at recess and got herself filmed because she was so angry that Jamie Oliver was making them eat healthy food in the school. And so this was cited, and you can imagine what the current president would do with this, with parents who are revolting and saying, no, we want our kids to have food because that's the United Kingdom way, that's the American way.
Can I also give a big endorsement to this Mayor Khan's proposal here? Because as a formerly fat kid, I think I'm the only one who can speak on this particular panel. Oh, that's right. I forgot about you.
Yeah.
To this issue, I ate what was closest. And while I would prefer not to have healthy food when I was a kid, if healthy-ish food was closer than unhealthy food, I would tolerate the healthier alternative because I didn't want to. I wanted proximity. I wanted convenience. So I think this thing could have huge impact.
Well,
I think
it still
it's great.
Applies because schedules allow kids only so much room time,
right.
before they get out, and then they get docked grades.
Okay, let's talk about salt and blood pressure. I guess we knew this, right? That we're not supposed to have very much salt and that that helps lower blood pressure.
But this story's better, saying that essentially it's as effective, if not more, reducing salt intake, sodium intake, is as effective, if not more, than blood pressure medicine. Once again, Medford's own Michael Bloomberg was on to something with those little salt shakers on the menus.
Oh, Bloomberg was on to a lot with sodium. So sodium has been vilified. The idea that you should reduce sodium and it will reduce your chances of having a heart attack has been decried as fake science by salt lovers. So this is unfortunately been one of the areas of attack among people who don't like nutrition and food police. But so that's the background of this study that was reported in the Post. It's from the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. It's very straight-faced, but it's not saying there's a storm of controversy behind this. And the controversy is people who say you can really have as much sodium as you like, whereas anybody in the nutrition community will say the single greatest thing you can do to improve public health is decrease the amount of sodium in the diet. So this was a study that found like a linear relationship between reduced sodium, reduced blood pressure, which means you're at much less risk of heart attack and stroke.
Is the primary use of salt preservation or taste in America's diet in 2017?
I'm glad you asked that,
Jim. Oh, because you don't know the answer?
I know some of the answer.
Okay, what is the answer?
Which is a tremendous amount of the salt in our diets is used as a preservative. It's not used for flavor, and we're completely unaware of it. For example, what is the single greatest contributor of salt in the diet?
Bread. I know. That is amazing.
Yeah, and it's entirely to improve shelf life. So when I did a piece last year for the Times Magazine about what food industry is doing to improve health, didn't focus on sugar, didn't focus on fat. I focused on sodium because the people I trust in the public health community say this is the single most important thing you can do. And it really is silent because you don't know that it's in your food.
But one thing, because
I
do like salt.
I don't like salt shakers on the menus
in
New York City.
I like
ruins my
salt
good time.
On certain things like meat, which
especially
I don't
when
eat
it
that.
Comes to dessert.
But this
try
is
horseradish.
Like, hold on, would you let me finish, please?
No.
This is another one of these things that some of this has to be hereditary and how much you heavy you are, because lots of people like myself do not have high blood pressure and I do eat salt. So you don't. Everybody doesn't have. It's like some people are affected by different things. You know,
the poster child for the fake news. We like sodium, Kim.
Well, not we like sodium, but it doesn't mean that if you don't have high blood pressure, you have healthy blood pressure, and you use salt, then you're lucky. Maybe.
Yes, you are lucky, and I'm going to artfully dodge this by saying one of the encouraging findings in the study was the higher your sodium at the beginning, the more dramatic the results of lowering sodium and lowering your blood pressure. So you'd be even better off if you weren't like Marjorie with the luck of having inherited lower sodium.
But that's irresponsible on your part, if I may say so, because you have unbelievable genes. You've never been heavy your whole life.
No, but I have bad genes, actually. My poor parents keeled over early, but not from high blood pressure.
Sorry about that, then. Forget that.
Not from high blood pressure.
One of the things that wasn't mentioned in the study is African-American community has disproportionately high blood pressure.
Yeah.
And they are among the highest beneficiaries of lowering sodium in their diet.
Okay, so I asked you before about whether or not anybody was doing what Mayor Khan was proposing to do over there in London. Is anybody doing the salt shaker on the menu thing? And by the way, for those who don't know, we've discussed this before, I think including with you. And this was upheld, unlike the soda size ban, which was struck down by a higher court in New York. I believe the salt ban was up, not ban, was the salt notice on menus in New York City. I don't know which restaurants. If the salt, the sodium content is above X, whatever X is.
2,300 milligrams a day, which is the recommended daily allowance.
So then they have a little salt shaker on the thing, which is to show you
which
that says, maybe
guess
you better
what?
Go easy.
This one entree has as much salt as you should be having in an entire day.
So is anybody else doing this, or is this just New York City?
No, and it's not going to be part of the menu labeling law that's supposed to go into effect May something 2018.
Because of lobbying from the other side?
Partly lobbying from the other side, and also partly because the anti-sodium people led by Marjorie Egan were really? Very much against this so when selfish. Menu labeling was being discussed.
Okay. So we read where Snickers is going to invest in Kind, this huge maker of snack bars. Why do I care about this?
Well, this is a victory of the good guys. So until proved otherwise,
okay.
Both Kind bars, which marketed clear cellophane wrapping that shows you every nut and every piece of fruit in your healthful oat bar, or chia seeds, and Mars Corporation, the country's sixth largest privately held company.
I didn't know they were that big. Wow.
They're huge.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
And a lot of their fortune and profits are from pet food, which is a little known fact,
wow.
But it's a huge part of Mars. And I think we might be talking about pet food later.
Right, yeah.
They both do very good things for nutrition. So Mars has invested many hundreds of millions of dollars in mapping the genome of the cacao plant, which is for many reasons endangered, and making it public knowledge, making it open source, so anybody can go and figure out how can I grow cacao better, how can I try to breed cacao better, and improve the lot of the people as they do, Mars does, in Africa who are growing it. So there's lots of quiet things that these companies do for good that they don't particularly talk about.
But wait, baby. I don't want to rain on your, I was going to say your nuts, but I probably should. Giving the nuts and fruit
excuse
kind of thing.
Me,
that's what I was going to say. But you know what? Chelsea and I were talking earlier this morning, and she printed out nutritional information on the whole notion is Mars wants to get healthier. That's why they're buying into the Kind thing. Listen to this comparison. Admittedly, a Snickers bar has more calories, 250 to 190. Saturated fat in a Snickers bar, total fat in a Snickers bar, 12. Total fat in an almond and coconut Kind bar, want to guess? 12. Total saturated fat in a Snickers, 4.5 grams. Total saturated fat in a Kind bar, 5. So what I want you
everything.
To I want you to disabuse me of this notion. The reason Kind has gotten away with this notion that we are a healthier snack bar, I think, is more because of the packaging, because there's this literal transparency where, as you said, you can see into the bar, but they don't appear to be that much healthier than a traditional chocolate bar, which is horrible for you. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I think what you have to look at is the amount of added sugars and the amount of fat that comes from nut fat. And I think Snickers, it's nuts, and Kind, it's nuts. So as long as you're having a lot of your fat from nuts, that's supposed to be the good fat right now, as opposed to different kinds of saturated fat.
But would you not agree with me that the packaging was the brilliance
oh,
with
it's
the
not
guy
just the packaging, it's the marketing of the whole brand, yeah. You know, saying we're good to the people who grow the stuff.
Are they?
As far as I know, they are. You know, with all these things, Kind has a huge halo. I've met the founder. Everybody who meets Daniel Lubetzky, the founder, is utterly captivated by his mission. His book, Do the Kind Thing, was a big bestseller. So he's managed a feat of branding. Mm. So it's really worked so far. And, you know, we'll see. It's still proved otherwise.
Okay, Corby Cummer, our food man. There's a great piece in The Guardian, which I love, and we're all supposed to contribute to The Guardian so they can stay in business. Anyway.
As long as you're here, that's what the box at the end of every Guardian
yeah,
says.
Yeah, I know.
As long as you're here, give us some money.
Well, you could give them a little bit.
And
you know,
I do.
It helps them toward their staying afloat because they do great journalism.
Wait a minute. Just last week I gave you some money.
But it doesn't. Well, I know. That's the thing they keep asking you, even if you're already given. But in any case.
You don't have to, though.
You don't have to. That's right. But you want to support certain things, Jim, and that's a good one to support. But anyway, this does not surprise me at all. The restaurant business in general and being a chef in particular is very bad for your health and this story, your mental health. So elaborate on this. What is happening? Why
so
is this?
First of all, The Guardian, what was interesting about this piece was it was written by a guy named Jay Rayner, and he is many people's poster child. If you want to find a vicious, sardonic, slash-and-burn critic, it is Jay Rayner. So when you are looking for a go-to, and I had my students recently look for complete pans and the most vicious restaurant reviews they could find, and Jay Rayner is always at the top of the list, and yet this is a completely straight-faced, look at the stress these guys face, look at the mental illness, look at the self-destructive damage. So this was started about 2 years ago. There was a confessional by Rene Redzepi of Noma Restaurant, which in several surveys is the world's best restaurant. He's a big spokesperson for chefs, and he wrote something about mental health and chefs and how difficult it was. And it unleashed a torrent on his MAD restaurant site, it's called MAD, about chefs and mental health and how challenging it is, how many chefs overcome depression, suffer from depression, and it began this confessional stream. And somehow it petered out, like in the past year. For a while it was a torrent. Daniel Patterson, a very respected chef who comes from here, a patrician background he tries to hide from right here in Boston, is a three-star chef, Coe Restaurant in San Francisco, and he wrote about suffering from depression and how suddenly when he talked about it with other chefs, opens the floodgates. This is a huge problem. There's a woman named Kat Kinsman who started a fund to help chefs in Brooklyn. I mean, she started the fund in Brooklyn, but it's nationwide. It's a huge problem, depression and chefs. But it's not talked about because it's part of this macho, tough power through. But in fact, access to alcohol is huge, and it's an enormous problem, alcohol abuse.
Didn't the story say that 50% plus of these chefs have some drug or alcohol issue?
Well, you can see where at the end of the day in restaurants there is a big tendency to hit the local bar room or sometimes even a drink at the
because
place
it's there. And yeah. I've been very interested in the, we've talked about sexual harassment stories in kitchens, but yep. A sort of concomitant piece that you often see about this is in the context of harassment is access to alcohol is so widespread that often leads to situations in which chefs harass. But they haven't talked as much about the underlying problems of alcoholism and addiction, which are big in kitchens. And
by the way, it's not just alcohol. It's the macho culture. It's what you've described to us, Anthony Bourdain described to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is this super hyper macho culture
and the long
in a
hours.
Lot of these kitchens, right?
Yeah, but what goes with it often is this kind of brash toughness that's very hard to maintain and the punishing hours that require some kind of release. So I don't, you know, there can't be enough of these stories. And I'm glad that Jay Rayner, who usually, you know, specializes in cutting vicious wit, decided to draw attention to this.
We're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy.
So, Corby, I'm embarrassed to say this story about Venezuela stunned me. I knew they were in trouble down there. I had no idea that it was as bad as it is.
80% people living in poverty, 800% inflation rate, hyperinflation there. There is a story. Whoever wrote this piece, Kirk Semple, had so many great little examples. One of the things they talk about, which really brought it home, the nation is on the I got the wrong paragraph here. This is an economy in which even the hourly rate in a parking lot recently ticked upward in the 2 hours it took a shopper to run some errands. Then it talks about this 42-year-old hairdresser, David, who, like many Venezuelans, spends a lot of time waiting in line to buy basic goods when they're available. The other day, he woke at 5 a.m. He's got three kids and stood in line for 2.5 hours to buy a canister of cooking gas. By the time he got to the front of the line, the supply had run out. So there are gross food shortages, hyperinflation.
Yeah.
This is a
consumer prices forecast just soar more than 2,300% in the next year.
So I tweeted this, which of course is the reason you saw it. Because
it is, of course. Well, actually, a friend of mine showed it to me before they.
No, it was my tweet. She found it through my tweet.
That's very possible.
And I said, this is not Berlin in the 1920s when people had wheelbarrows of money and they tried to run to the store before the prices rose, which happened here. It's not Zimbabwe under the worst of Mugabe, who did the same thing, hyperinflation. This is happening right now kind of under our noses. And the student I was just teaching at Tufts, she's just become engaged to a Venezuelan, and she said, oh, that hairdresser went to the same school my fiance did, and it's even worse than this story says. But the fact that the story was so well reported and has specific examples that bring it right home is the power of journalism.
And yeah, the power of journalism to, and then finish the sentence, cause us to say how horrible this is and do absolutely nothing. Is that?
Well, to remember the neediest, as the Times says every December, to try to think about, you know, I sent this story around because I was so affected by this story, and one of my friends said, okay, look at it in Boston. You want to go, you can go around the corner and you can find the story in Boston. It just happens that this was so well done. But the idea.
Well, the difference is this is every corner. I mean, this is practically, when you have 80%, when your poverty rate is 80%, you don't have to look around the corner. You have to look about
it also brings up the larger point, which is that famines are always a factor of government misdistribution. They are not a factor of there's been a drought or some kind of act of God. Famines are always a problem with government. And the mismanagement in Venezuela and its oil, it's entirely the evils of government that have led to this hyperinflation and hunger.
Well, let me just say one last thing about this. The only person other than you, Corby Comer, who put attention on this because of your brilliant tweet that everybody saw.
Captivated the nation.
Do you know who also talked about Venezuela, I'm sure for the wrong reasons, and was talking about imposing sanctions on Venezuela not too long ago?
Anybody in
your
Washington?
Your favorite president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, was talking about
because
this.
Because of this?
I don't think it was a humanitarian kind of motivation, but I have to say he put, for a brief period of time, more attention on Venezuela in general than the gnat-like attention spans of most Americans can handle. So the question is, will this Kirk Semple piece engender any action? I hope it does. We're talking to Corby Comer, our food guy.
This is a very unfortunate segue. Talking
I'm so
about
glad you're
people.
Doing it instead of me.
It's a tough segue.
Take it away,
nothing
Marguerite.
To eat but a cupful of rice in Venezuela, and then we segue to the ultimate in eating for dogs and cats. Explain what's going on here, please, Corby Comer.
Oh, so pet food trends mirror human food trends because people ascribe human qualities to their cats and dogs.
Yes, we do.
So they want them to have just what they're having because if it's good enough for them, it's certainly good enough for Fido. Though, when have you met a dog named Fido? and so this is something that the Mars Company and other everybody takes notes of this. So now there's gluten-free pet food. I mean, there really is. There's low-carb pet food, low-saturated fat. It always follows human...
Cell-cultured?
Well, so now there's going to be cell-cultured
What does that
meat.
Mean?
So cell-cultured, as I have written about recently in The Atlantic and NeoLife, a new website started by MIT people, there's now cell-cultured fish. So there's going to be cell-cultured fish. Mm-hmm. There's cell-cultured meat. Two companies, Memphis Meats and Modern Meadow, which sounds so Orwellian, they all have M names, are trying to, you take a couple of cells of a recently died animal, you didn't even have to kill it, it could have just expired in the zoo or the aquarium, and you try to replicate it in a test tube and try to build it out so that, you know, the way they're trying to grow transplant organs, they are trying to grow meat. And what was not stated in this otherwise very good piece in Quartz about pet food is one of the reasons it's going to show up first in pet food is it has no texture and no taste.
Oh.
All it's got is the protein and the heme, iron, and the things that are good nutritionally about meat. And so it's easy to stuff into pet food because they don't need the bone or they don't need the requirement, or you can just grind
up dead
bones. Wait a
second. Didn't you tell us a couple of months ago in a segment that they were trying to do the exact same thing, creating meat in a test tube for human beings?
Absolutely.
Which obviously would have to have taste.
Right, but you're only seeing it now in burgers and things that don't require any texture, because trying to mimic the striation of muscles, mimic the bone and fat and cartilage structure is this huge problem. But just growing out a couple of, and that's one of the reasons that fish fillets are going to be easier because they've got like no texture.
When they take the cells from the dead animal, what are they growing? Are they growing?
They're growing those cells. They put them in a medium that's a warm bath of nutrients.
Yeah, so it's like a blob.
And often they put it on something that looks in diagrams like a Lego set, a structure in which they try to mimic the structure of, say, a drumstick. That's about as far as they've gotten. You know, they're not going to get as far as a breast or something that's really complicated. Because here's one of the charming facts. If every cell doesn't have easy access to this bath of nutrients, it will become gangrenous.
Perfect. Oh, God.
Well, you just cut that portion off and you eat the rest.
Yeah, okay. That's right. And put it to your pet food.
Thank you. On that note, okay, Corby Comer, pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Corby Comer. Corby is an award-winning food writer, restaurant critic, senior editor at The Atlantic, and columnist for The New Republic. He's also a BPR contributor. Corby, thank you very much, as always, for coming in.
See you, Corby.
Coming up, We're opening up the lines and asking you, like, if you, like Jim Brady, would prefer to have a chatbot therapist.
I'll speak for myself, thank you.
Chatbot, that is.
That is exactly
to
right.
To a real human psychiatrist with a couch and a wall full of diplomas and experience. Why would you want that? So that you can really tell the chatbot what you wouldn't tell your therapist. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. A 2014 poll, I think it was, found that shoppers preferred cashiers to the self-checkout. A 2013 poll found that people preferred a real bank teller to an ATM. So does this not bode well for the Wobot? A Wobot is a therapist that doesn't have a couch, a box of tissues, or a wall decorated with diplomas, because it's nothing more than an online chatbot. You might like having a human bag up your groceries, but do you want a human to unpack your baggage? The number is 877-301-8970. Does the idea of a robot therapist appeal to you? It's cheap, it's 24/7, and most importantly, it does not judge. 877-301-8970. By the way, if you think it's one of these crackpot ideas, as we just mentioned a half hour, 20 minutes ago, to Art Kaplan, apparently, is it since June, Marjorie, 2 million people have used this service? I think it's since June. I may be off by a few months, but I think that's the gist of it.
It's gaining fast in popularity.
It's $39 a month, a month after your first two-week free trial. And in light of the fact, you know, Chelsea mentioned this to us this morning, we were talking about this, for those of us who shall remain unnamed, who have seen a shrink from time to time in our existence, it is amazing that you pay to go see the shrink to unload your problems, and then you lie to your shrink because you're so embarrassed about your problems. I may have had that issue myself once or twice. And for those who are scoffing at this, which is what I did until I actually read this, was it the Washington Post? The story, yeah, in the Washington Post in the health section. The average user, at least the average user with whom Amy Ellis Nutt, who wrote this piece, communicated, had incredibly positive feedback about how useful the experience was. And I think it's in part because of the non-judgment thing, because you can say whatever the hell you want. It's a machine. And by the way, it's not just like programmed in a way like Art was talking about where it just says yes or no. It apparently has, its functionality is such that it can almost communicate with you in normal human-to-human kind of
fashion. They have a sample conversation.
Go ahead.
Who else in your family takes care of you? Answer, my father. Your father. You are like my father in some ways. Oh, what resemblance do you see? You are not very aggressive, but I think you don't want me to notice that. What makes you think I'm not very aggressive? You don't argue with me. And it goes on and on and on. And the people
had that exact same conversation for $180, by the way.
That's right.
Not too long
and
ago.
And you didn't want to tell them that your father was in jail. And I
he was
don't blame
not in
you
jail.
For being
he was disbarred.
About that.
He was not in jail.
And the other thing is, I think people like the idea that it checks, the Wobot checks in with them on a regular basis. And they find that
it's
very,
programmed to check back with you.
Yes, to check back with you. And I think that you can get your fix fast, as opposed to having to make an appointment with a therapist for 2 weeks from now, when maybe you won't feel as down the dumps as you do at the moment that you feel like you need your therapist. So it's an instant gratification thing, too.
And by the way, a lot of health insurance does not cover, at least doesn't cover adequately, mental health treatment. And a lot of shrinks these days won't even take a lot of insurance. So maybe it's not your first choice, but for $39 a month, it apparently is an adequate second choice for a stunning number, 2 million people, according to this, since June or something? That was what it was? Yeah, since June.
Yeah.
It launched in June. It engages in more than, it's much more than this. It engages in more than 2 million conversations a week, they say. 2 million a week.
So millions of Americans are dealing with their mental health issues by talking to a Wobot.
A Wobot.
You know, I was down at the I told you the Hub Week when they had all those robots.
All the robots running around,
And some of these robots are really amazing, and you're having conversations with the robots. Mm-hmm. And I went to this thing at the New York City Marathon where they had this little robot doing a demonstration, mm-hmm. and you could talk to the robot, and the robot moves its head, and it changes the intonation of its voice, mm-hmm. and so you get really easily, fooled into thinking that there's something in there besides this. It's like R2-D2 in those years ago in those great Star Wars movies. You know what I mean?
Remember one of our producers said the first time he went to an ATM with his girlfriend thought there was a human standing behind there when they... So, I mean, everybody... Whatever. Let's go to Bob in Worcester. You are first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Wobots, as we call them. It's W-O-E-B-O-T. Hey there, Bob.
Well, I think it's probably a good idea. I get my therapy from listening to you guys. So, and the responses are perfectly adequate. You know, if you listen long enough, you know, Jim will say something that makes me feel better because I know I'm not that dumb. So.
Well, I'm glad I'm performing a service, Bob. That's why I'm here.
There you go.
So, Bob, would you ever?
Business with the theaters, the surgeon's fee was $200. The medical facility fee was $1,800. The hospital eventually dropped it because of an NPR healthcare reporter who was looking into it.
Well, that's good to hear.
So it worked out for the lady.
Well, it worked out, but they shouldn't have been charged $1,877 for something you get free with a $5 pair of earrings at the mall. But, Bob, thanks for your... praise, I guess. Bob, yeah. Thank you for the call.
Stephen emails, and he's on not just the robot, but the ATM that you said before.
Sure.
And he says you shouldn't, you know, deride the ATM and the human behind the ATM, because Stephen says, I had an actual major breakthrough talking to the ATM just this morning.
I'm sure.
So there you go. It can happen, kind of.
You know, by the way, does that not, you know, there are certain things. You and I think it's fair to say, are not experts on artificial intelligence.
Are you
Would you
kidding?
Agree that's
Absolutely
the case?
Not.
But are you not surprised almost every day when you read a story about AI about how many more things? Like, if before you read the story this morning, if I had said to you there's a robotic alternative, far cheaper and apparently relatively useful for people who need therapy, you would have said that's not possible, wouldn't you have said that?
I would find it very surprising.
2 million conversations a week in this country.
Did you see that? You saw that movie, Her.
Oh, of course.
Where the guy fell in love with the operating
system. What's the name of the guy who did that?
I forget. The operating system on his computer he fell in love with. And
Joaquin Phoenix.
John Parker, who knows everything, our engineer, John Parker. And Joaquin Phoenix goes away to this cabin in the woods
Scarlett
for the
Johansson.
Weekend with the operating system.
Yes.
And he's talking to her at the end of the day. He's talking to her in the morning. She's listening to his problems. I mean, it's kind of like a talking dog in a way that can relate to your difficulties and listens to you.
Well, there are also, if you read certain websites, which I don't go to but others do, some people are using inflatables for other purposes that you
really?
Wouldn't think that I have not done
oh,
that.
Oh, what are they using for, Jim?
I wouldn't. You have to talk to a friend of mine who's a long-distant friend of mine. Let's go to Dan in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Wobots, which are robotic therapists, essentially. Would you use them? Hi, Dan.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Excellent. What's going on?
Great. Just of all the things we could be talking about, I call in on this subject.
Yeah, it says something.
Yeah, it does. It was a very slow afternoon. But, I was thinking that if we design this robot to look like Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, that's not
those,
nice.
She has kind of those robotic eyes on her, and she's always trying to tell people how to live their lives. So I think that, you know, that probably would be a good matchup for this thing.
Well, we have a Democratic congressman on tomorrow, Richie Neal. We'll pass it on, Dan. I'm sure he'll be very receptive to the idea. Thank you
for
your call.
Well, some of the Democratic congressmen have been trying to get rid of Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the Democrats, and Seth Moulton is among them.
Seth Moulton, well, he wouldn't say get rid of her. He voted for the guy, what was his name, Ryan from
Ohio?
Well,
he didn't want her to be the head of the, he didn't want her to be speaker anymore. Yeah. I think that he's not alone in that sentiment. Elizabeth from Rhode Island, what do you think? The robot could solve your problems?
Welcome. Hi.
So here's the deal. I agree. I'm so glad that this is a subject. People need to seek mental health counseling. I get it. I love it. But on a personal level, man, the validation I get from another human being is so amazing. Maybe I'm just vain, but for somebody to tell me, oh, my gosh, you were right, that person was so wrong, man, that's good.
Yeah, but on a serious note, I agree with you. As someone who more than once has seen a therapist in my life,
maybe that doesn't happen to you, Jim. But maybe there's the no validation. Say there's not the validation.
But you know, on a serious note here, while this idea seems preposterous in some ways, it's $39 a month, and I'll tell you. We get email all the time. Not that I didn't know this from reading the papers or real life. There, it is almost impossible to find therapists these days who have slots in their schedules, or if they have slots in their schedules, Elizabeth, are willing to take in, your insurance in such a way that it doesn't break the bank. So, you know, for those people, this is a big deal. What's that?
And that's why it makes sense. I totally agree with you in that respect. And I feel fortunate that I have a regular therapist,
mm-hmm.
and I feel lucky and fortunate that my insurance covers part of that. But yes, on a whole scale, I think this is great. People need to seek mental help wherever they can get it. And if it's a computer, all right, whatever.
I'm exactly where you are, actually. It's not my first choice, but I am fine. And by the way, just saying the words, even if you appreciate that it's just a machine, having the words cross your, that in and of itself is often cathartic. So I think there are a lot of pluses here. Elizabeth, thanks for a great call.
Barbara just emails and says, I think the same thing can be accomplished by talking to any stranger that you don't anticipate meeting again. Barbara works part-time. She's often assigned to self-service, where oddly, she says, more people talk to me about holiday decorations, their dying parents, care of their demented mother, etc. And that's sort of the phenomenon of people that go to the barbershop, even though you tend to go to the same
barbershop. Uber drivers.
Hairdressers. Yes, exactly. I mean, how many times do you go to the hairdresser and hear these incredibly intimate conversations going on between the stylist and the person that's sitting next to you in the chair?
Hmm.
You know, you do find out about the lives of your hairdresser.
It's the only reason
time.
I go.
Yeah.
That's what my
but
place
if it's the
is
same hairdresser, then it's not a stranger, so you have a different relationship, obviously, with the person you go see all the time. But you do hear these conversations, don't you?
Yes, you do. 877-301-8970.
Has your barber gotten you through many difficult moments?
He's
in your
actually
life,
a good friend of mine. I've known him for decades.
Oh, okay.
It's Alfred, I've told you.
Oh,
that.
Alfred,
Alfred
that's
is one
right.
of my best buddies.
Yeah.
He's the sweetest
guy. So you can't
guy.
Be totally honest with Alfred because then he wouldn't hang around with you anymore.
Exactly.
Let's go to Russell.
That is exactly right. By the way, for people who have not been to a therapist, it may sound ridiculous what we were talking about at the beginning. You'd say to yourself, well, why would you go and spend $200 an hour or whatever it is if you don't intend to be fully honest? It's really hard when you have embarrassing things, like when you went to confession when you were a little kid,
doing things
you shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah,
I assume you were going weekly.
Well,
did you?
Not weekly.
Well, you should have been going weekly.
Right. Okay.
Did you ever tell the priest the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
Often not. It's certainly not to a priest that you knew. If you had something really bad,
exactly, it's
you
the
wanted
same
to go
thing.
To a place like St. Anthony's Shrine because they're doing like, you know, assembly line confessions down there and they hear so much bad stuff, you could just kind of slip in the
but
cracks.
But it's the same concept.
Yes, it's the same concept. And I can, you know, I was just thinking in terms of sex harassment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of these guys must have known they had a little bit of a problem or that maybe they were misbehaving.
You mean the perpetrators?
Yes. Not all of them. Not a lot of them, I'm sure, didn't care. They thought they could get away with it. But those who did, are you going to go to your therapist? Like if you're Louis C.K., now maybe if you're Louis C.K. because you're so out there, but tell them that.
But that's the whole point of a therapist. And whole point is to strip yourself naked, not literally, but that's a whole other issue. No, I'm serious.
Issue, yeah.
So that, I mean, that's the only way you get unburdened with these things.
Was
but
Tony
it is really
Soprano
hard to do.
Was Tony honest with his therapist?
Were they some of the greatest scenes
they
in the history
great
of television?
But was he totally honest with her? I don't remember.
I think he was pretty honest with her.
Yeah.
He was pretty honest. Well, let's take a few more calls. Let's go to Seekonk, where Jane is on the phone. Jane, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a retired psychiatric nurse practitioner.
Great. Perfect. We're so
Perfect.
Glad you called. What do you think?
Well, I'll be very honest with you. For people who have less than acute and critical problems, I think that this is a gateway for them to get their problems taken care of. However, there are so many people who want to unburden themselves of very serious issues. Right now, the biggest issue in the United States is depression, and depression with irritability, with alcohol abuse, drug abuse, that this is not an appropriate venue for them to unburden themselves for the simple reason that when I had a patient, my last job was in El Paso, Texas. and I was with the VA. When people want to unburden themselves of something very serious, then it's important to have the body language, the eye contact. I could tell when somebody was fibbing to me. It didn't take a genius. And the therapeutic relationship of knowing that your caregiver cares about you is very important.
But, Jane, let me just interrupt and say some of the comments that the WoBot users made was that they thought the WoBot cared about them because it followed up with them about medication, about how they were. You know what I mean? And I'm not suggesting, you're right, of course, for the most acute psychological problems, hopefully you're not using the machine. But you can appreciate that if you're checked in with it. I'm assuming particularly with older people, with lonely older people, it's a big asset, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is, if it checks back with you, I know nothing about the details of that program.
Well, we don't know much either.
If it checks back with you, if there's a human a therapist who can validate that this person needs a referral to two or three therapists in their area, then social workers are usually the first persons to offer counseling.
Yeah.
And an evaluation by a psychiatric person for a diagnosis to see if there's something even bigger going on is really mandatory.
Hey, Jane, that was great. Thank you so much for bringing some expertise into the discussion. You know what part of the problem is, Marjorie?
What?
Almost every time you go to the shrink and the shrink would say, "You did?" I mean, that is not helpful. It's just, you sort of don't feel... You know what I would say in those circumstances?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Get me a WoBot. Yeah. No, I'm serious. No, but that is how you feel they were going to react, even though they never do.
Christian in Hampton Falls. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Christian.
Hi. I wanted to speak a funny point to what you were saying earlier is when people want to pay somebody money and then they lie to a therapist, it's kind of like somebody hiring a cleaning person and then freaking out and saying, "I have to clean up for the cleaning person that's coming."
Yeah. Who doesn't do that? Who doesn't clean up for the cleaning person? Everybody, right?
But then if nobody's coming to clean up, then they end up not even cleaning anything at all.
That's a great analogy, actually, Christian. So what does that say? What's the deeper meaning in that analogy?
Well, I think people need something or somebody to sort of either look after them or to look up to or to talk to. So I think technology maybe will be able to fill that. But I don't know if it'll be – I bet there'll be studies in coming years doing maybe brain scans or something. Like I know there's the part of the brain, I think it's the cerebral cortex, something that's the part that activates when you're talking to somebody. Mm-hmm. I bet that'll it'll activate some of the same things, but maybe we'll find out that it's not – it doesn't have all of the same benefits.
Very thoughtful call, Christian. Thank you for checking in with us.
You know, Jeff just points out the downside of getting too attached to your robot.
What's that?
Your WoBot, whatever it is.
WoBot.
He says it's important to point out that at the end of the movie Her, the girlfriend, Samantha, she's the operating system, the computer, leaves Joaquin Phoenix for a better guy.
Yeah.
So much for non-judgmental.
I saw her on a plane. I didn't see the end. Is
imagine
that what happens?
If your WoBot is that what says, leaves you? See you later, I have a better,
that would be
class clientele.
That'd be
we're all done. Okay.
By the way, people are emailing, it's WoBot, W-O-E, as in woe.
That's right.
Woe is me. WoBot is the name of this particular service that we're doing free advertising for.
Okay, coming up, we're going to talk with John Rosenthal, co-founder of Stop Handgun Violence. He's using the tactics of the anti-tobacco movement to bring about gun reform. John Rosenthal is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and I live. I'm Jim Browdy, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Last week, incredibly, the House Judiciary Committee voted 19-11 for a bill that would allow concealed carry permit holders from one state to legally carry their guns to any other state. This is the first gun-related legislation since 58 people were murdered in Las Vegas It's called the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act of 2017. We've actually discussed it with Commissioner Evans. Legislation the NRA describes as its highest legislative priority. Well, this week, Stop Handgun Violence is launching a campaign of their own using graphic images from the Las Vegas shooting to urge Trump and Congress to wipe the blood off their hands by mandating background checks and renewing the federal assault weapons ban. John Rosenthal, of course, is the co-founder of Stop Handgun Violence and the man behind it all. John, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So there was a flurry of hope after the terrible massacre in Las Vegas that we were going to do something. There's a flurry of brief hope after a lot of these mass shootings, but we talked about bump stocks and maybe even doing something with background checks. And once again, as Jim said, nothing's happened.
Massachusetts is the only state that acted since Las Vegas, and we banned bump stocks.
First state in the country, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And after Sandy Hook, when I was back here with you all, which is, by the way, over 150,000 dead people ago, just in 5 years from gun violence, Congress did nothing when 20 babies, first graders, were massacred. Except for promote this concealed carry reciprocity law, which, make no mistake about it, this is about undermining state gun laws in order to increase gun violence, increase fear, and increase gun sales. So Massachusetts is an urban industrial state. We have arguably the most effective gun laws in the nation. We've reduced the rate of gun deaths by 60% since 1994, when we started the billboard campaign, and I'm a gun owner, as you know, and we have the lowest firearm fatality rate in the nation. We have proven the NRA's worst nightmare. Gun laws save lives. The problem is that as you reduce gun deaths, you reduce fear, and as you reduce fear, you reduce gun sales. And now in particular, which is the sort of the truth is stranger than fiction aspect of all this, because Trump is president and is in bed with the NRA, there's no fear of Democrats taking your guns away anymore, and gun sales have plummeted. How do you increase gun sales? You increase gun violence and increase fear. So the two things that they have, the NRA and Trump, are doing, and they have very willing partners in Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, the two pieces of legislation, one of them was coming up the day of the Las Vegas massacre.
Was that the silencer one?
Yes.
The silencer one. Yeah, tell people about that.
So Donald Trump Jr. is heavily invested in the silencer business.
I didn't know that.
Yes, as an investor. And in the 30s, when machine guns were banned, silencers were banned because it helped, you know, silencers helped criminals get away with murder without detection. Mm-hmm. So they've been banned since the 30s. No one ever, you know, thought about deregulating or reducing or eliminating the ban on machine guns or silencers until Trump came into office. You can no longer sue the gun industry, thanks to George W. Bush. So now the NRA is going for broke. They are doubling down. They gave $30 million to Trump. They own him. They have a seat at the table at the White House, and their priorities were silencers in order to make it easier to get away with murder without detection, and that bill was coming up the day of Las Vegas.
And imagine if the Las Vegas shooter had a silencer.
Imagine. I mean, people are alive today because they heard the shots fired. They heard where the shooter was firing from. So law enforcement is able to sort of solve crimes because people hear shots, and we have a shot spotter here in Boston. So if shots are fired, police go to that scene. So, and then the concealed carry reciprocity.
Well, stay on silencer for a second. I could make an argument for the NRA. It's not one I believe, in defense of much of what's on their agenda. When that silencer thing came up, I don't know if we discussed this on the air or not, I couldn't come up with one. And you came up with a minute because they want people to be able to murder and not be detected. I mean, what's their public argument as to why that the Second Amendment is pure? Is that what is it?
They're calling it the Sportsman Hearing Protection Act.
So it doesn't damage their eardrums when they're killing an animal? Is that what they really say?
Yes. Okay. And I shoot. I've hunted. I don't know anybody who's a legitimate gun owner that doesn't wear ear protection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about, you know, they call it one thing, but what they really mean is unrestricted access to guns and make it easier to people for people to kill each other without law enforcement knowing it.
And they were embarrassed out of proceeding with that on that particular date because the timing was bad for them. Okay, then the concealed carry thing, which passed this. Did I get right with Judiciary or Rules Committee or something?
Committee.
So the rationale, before the rationale, explain better than I did. If you're from a state that has very low threshold of what you need to get a permit for a concealed carry, you can bring a concealed weapon into a place like Massachusetts where the threshold, I assume, is quite high, and you can't be stopped by anybody.
Driver's
is that
license.
Correct?
That's what I read. It's like you get your license in
right,
Texas,
that's a good enough.
And your driver's license is good in all 50 states. So that's my understanding. You get your concealed carry permit in Texas, and you can show up at your kid's soccer game if your grandpa next weekend in wherever town you live in with a gun.
So is that's a good analogy, is it not?
So Jared Loughner, who shot Gabby Giffords
right.
and forever changed her life and killed six other people at a district office, went to a Walmart, had a background check run because only federally licensed gun dealers in America have to run a background check. So he had a prohibition from his military record, which is interesting, but it wasn't in the database. Right. He got a handgun. Now he's legal. He then could take it to Massachusetts, where we require background checks for all gun sales, training, licensing, renewable licensing, registration, and police chiefs have discretion not to issue licenses. So we are the safest state in the nation because we have the most effective gun laws. I'm a gun owner. I can pass a background check. But the NRA doesn't like gun laws because they reduce gun sales. They reduce gun deaths.
Okay, so let's follow, though, John Rosenthal from Stop Handgun Violence, Marjorie's example. If I get a driver's license in Kansas, I can drive in Massachusetts. If I get married in Kansas, I am married in Massachusetts. If I am allowed to carry a concealed weapon in Kansas, why shouldn't I be able to do the exact same thing in Massachusetts just like I can drive and be married?
Well, first of all, driver's licenses are not all created equally either. We happen to have renewable car licensing every 6 years like we have renewable gun licensing. In Kentucky, your car license is good for your whole life.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, states have the ability to regulate car licenses, and they certainly, according to the Supreme Court, Scalia wrote for the majority that you can't ban guns in the common use of the time of the founders, and he specifically said, I don't mean AR-15s or sawed-off
right.
shotguns. They weren't around, but you can put reasonable restrictions on how they are sold.
Is that the D.C. case of a
that
few years ago?
That was the D.C.
Okay.
Heller case.
Heller case, okay.
Tell us, you just handed me an invitation, and I opened it up, and I saw dead people lying on the ground with blood on them from Las Vegas. Tell me what you're doing, John Rosenthal.
Well, after Sandy Hook, I wanted to find the photographs of the 21st graders who each received 3 to 11 rounds with an AR-15 military-style assault weapon. The round it's called the 223 round. It is designed for stopping power, not to penetrate and go through you, but to create maximum soft tissue damage. Those 6 and 7-year-olds received 3 to 11 rounds. The entry wound is about a half inch in diameter. One exit wound is about a foot.
Oh my God.
And parents of those children told me that they had to identify their babies by their clothing. So think about Las Vegas. 58 people massacred and killed, and they were the lucky ones. 550 wounded forever with these gaping holes. If you look at those pictures closely, Marjorie, you will see bodies without heads. You will see bodies without arms from a military round that is perfectly legal to purchase in 33 states, along with the AR-15 assault rifle, at 5,000 gun shows every single day of the year without an ID or a background check, thanks to the NRA and their spineless members of Congress who prioritize blood money campaign contributions over 100 American lives a day lost to gun violence a mass shooting of four or more people every single day in this country, and now we're seeing these high-profile mass shootings every week or two.
So you're sending this to what I believe I read in the Globe yesterday was not only the president, but members of Congress who always vote with the NRA, inviting them to have an opportunity to get the blood off their hands, to give them two options in their RSVP. One is to vote the right way on assault weapons and background checks, and one is to continue the carnage. I have to say, I am totally with you, even though the pictures are appalling in terms of the methods, because my sense is we sanitize everything. We sanitize deaths of our children and siblings and parents in war and public executions by the state, and obviously a gun death like this. But what do you say to people who say this is too, I'm with you on the issue, John Rosenthal. I'm with you on background checks like 90% of America is and 70-some percent of the NRA is, but this is not okay. It is not okay. You dishonor the lives of those 58 people by showing them in these horrible settings. It's horrible for their family. It's too graphic, John Rosenthal.
I would say it's only a picture. What about reality? What about the families that how I had to identify their 6 and 7-year-olds at Sandy Hook with the same weapon 150,000 gun deaths ago, and it happened on October 1st in Las Vegas and then in Texas, and the list goes on and on. What's shocking is that elected officials who are supposed to be in Washington to protect the public health and safety have chosen millions of dollars. And in many cases, it's only, you know, tens of thousands or $100,000 buys a member of Congress to vote to make military-style weapons and easily concealed handguns unregulated. You know, you go down the store across the street and you can get a toy gun. That toy gun has a red dot at the end of the barrel. That is a federal regulation. That toy gun company cannot sell that gun unless it has a red dot at the end of the barrel. The firearm that did that mayhem in those pictures. I mean, Marjorie, one of those pictures are two beautiful teenage girls with blood all over them.
Yeah.
They're dead girls, thanks to Congress. And I've hunted. When I hunt, I got to get a license. And the NRA has no problem with the fact that you got to get a hunting license. And when you get a hunting license to hunt deer, you are limited to 5 rounds. And to hunt duck, you're limited to 3 rounds to protect the duck and deer population. But when you want to hunt people like Las Vegas, San Bernardino, the list goes on and on and on, no limit on the number of rounds, even though police carry 13 to 17 rounds before they have to reload. Congress says, mentally ill veteran with an AR-15, go for it, 100-round magazine.
What I wondered, John, and maybe this is already happening and I just don't know, but I know there's a Mothers Against Handgun, against Gun Violence as a group, but you know, I remember Mothers Against Drunk Driving. When I was young, 20, 30 years ago, people drove drunk and it was like a joke. You know, you'd make a joke about how you're reeling around, you basically made it home last night. Now people think of drunk drivers as bad people. You are a really bad person.
They change the culture.
And if there's a way to change the culture so that people, and we get them, they email me, all the time in these discussions that say, well, you know, I want to be able to go to the gun range and I want to be able to have these guns because it's fun. And I belong to the NRA. Can we make those people, and I'm sorry if you don't like this, but into bad people? Because what they're saying is my fun at the range or my freedom, that matters more than my life, liberty, and happiness, because I think most Americans are nervous now when they go to, the thought crosses your mind when you go to the mall, when you go to Fenway Park, when you go to Gillette Stadium, when you go any place where there's a crowd of people, is some lunatic going to come in here? You've lost your ease and a little bit of your enjoyment.
Think about this. What a false choice. So I'm a gun owner. Nobody's saying, ban guns.
Nobody's saying
I'm just saying guns. I'm a law-abiding gun owner, so I can go to a gun store. I am happy to go to a gun store because they have to run a background check. I resent the fact that Timothy McVeigh, the the biggest domestic terrorist we know from the Oklahoma bombing was an NRA member who blew up that building, killed 168 people because of the ATF regulating guns and the FBI being in that building. The NRA is not a gun rights organization. It's a cultural organization designed to, I mean, and Trump plays right into it, to create a cultural war. I mean, 90% of Americans support background checks. 70% of NRA members support background checks. A majority
of... But they're
of,
still members. They're still members the, of the NRA. Maybe
no,
they should
get
stop
this.
Being I mean, members.
Think about this. There are 80 million gun owners in this country. Mm-hmm. There's 4 million members of the NRA. The majority of American gun owners don't subscribe to the extremism of the NRA. And those 4 million members can't even vote for their board of directors. And let me tell you a little bit about their board of directors. Robert, wasn't it Palmer, he owns Soldier of Fortune. So that's the mercenary magazine. This guy, Jeff Cooper, was quoted as saying, 4 out of 5 people who die in the inner city from gun violence are no loss to society. We should keep them better armed.
Oh, God.
Another board member, Ted Nugent, put my face along with 11 other people with Jewish-sounding last names and said, these people, on the internet, it went viral, to his armed followers said, these Jews are responsible for gun control. Go shut them down.
Wow.
So this isn't a gun rights organization. This is a racist, anti-Semitic organization set out to create a cultural war. They were happy to have black kids killing black kids in the inner city. I've said for 25 years, 800,000 dead people ago since I built the billboard on the Mass Pike. Don't think that this war and this unrestricted access to guns is just going to stay in the inner city. At some point, it's going to the suburbs. And look who the mass shooters are now. They're largely angry white guys with AR-15s. And the last vote that Congress took after Trump became president was to lift the Obama-era ban on veterans who are under the care of somebody else because of a mental health crisis, lift the ban on them being able to buy weapons. And look, whether it's San Bernardino, Texas, Las Vegas, these are veterans with PTSD coming back and acting out their fantasies. And after every single time this happens, we are told, and we've talked about this a lot, after every single time, the NRA and Trump say, it's mental illness. Look, folks, U.S. doesn't have a lock on mentally ill people. There are mentally ill people everywhere. We just happen to arm them with military-style weapons without detection. That's why we have an epidemic of gun violence.
John Rosenthal, Stop Handgun Violence. Can we do one last thing on guns that's an up note? Because I never believed this would work. But let's end where you started. Even though we are bordered by a state that has some of the weakest gun laws in the country, New Hampshire, and wasn't it you who took Marjorie to the gun show in
Yes.
New Hampshire? What happened to the at the gun show? Tell quickly what the guy said to you when you...
Well, I wasn't supposed to be able to buy a high-capacity magazine because I'm from Massachusetts, and I told the guy that. He said, well, just make sure nobody pulls you over on the way home.
Okay, so...
They'll sell you whatever you want.
It's that kind of story that always
no
convinced
asked.
Me that no matter how far we went in Massachusetts, how far they went in Connecticut, it was not going to... There is evidence that really tough gun laws in states, while we'd all prefer, most of us would prefer to see them on the federal level, as long as we can't get them on the federal level, state laws matter. Why do they matter? I mean, they do matter, yes?
They absolutely matter,
and
Jim.
Why do they work so well when all you have to do is drive across the border and have the experience like you and Marjorie had?
Because we simply make it harder for people who are prohibited to buy guns. And that's the good news. I mean... As we started, we require gun owners, dealers, manufacturers, and law enforcement to all hold, be accountable for selling, owning, safe storage. We ban assault weapons, and we became the first state in the nation to require, like, the red dot on the end of a real gun, like so manufacturing standards, and we reduce gun deaths by 60% without banning anything except for those, you know, assault weapons and large-capacity ammunition magazines. So there's the hope, is that... If your goal is to reduce injuries and deaths from guns without banning most guns, you simply do what urban industrial Massachusetts has done. Mm-hmm. And we need to hold members accountable and do it on a state-by-state basis until we can change Congress and bring about sensible gun laws.
I want to give a shout-out, too, to St. Susanna's Parish in Dedham that set up its nativity scene. Fox News reported this, Fox 25, I should say. And right behind the nativity, behind Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, they placed a list of some of the deadliest mass shootings in our country's history. And the priest there, Stephen Josama, said the move was to get people talking and motivated to do whatever they can to combat gun violence. So good for St. Susanna's Parish.
And I am thrilled that our invitation that we sent to the 300 members of Congress who voted to restore the gun rights for mentally ill vets also were forced to see it in The Hill, which is the Capitol Hill newspaper.
Yeah, I read it on The Hill this morning, actually. Yeah,
so invitation landed and received.
Great.
John Rosenthal, thank you, as always. Thank you very much, and thank you for all your good work on this. John Rosenthal is the co-founder of Stop Handgun Violence. He is indefatigable. Is that how you pronounce it?
Indefatigable,
too. Whatever it is.
Not fatigable, but fatigable.
Fatigable. He works very hard. That's
and
what he does.
No tolerance for injustice.
He worked very hard, and he's co-chairman as well, the board of directors of the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. We didn't have a chance to
Which is trying to replicate what happened in Gloucester around the country. Next time you're here, we'll talk about
that.
I'm
sorry about that. But, John, thank you very much.
Great.
Coming up, is the GOP tax plan the most consequential legislation in the nation's history? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that and more. She is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and I, Jim Browdy, live from the GBH Studio at the Boston Public Library. When it comes to the GOP tax plan, it's hard to decide what makes it so remarkable. Is it the fact that benefits for the rich betray candidate Trump's pseudo-populism? Is it the fact the last-minute stocking stuffers were added to win over Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Jeff Flake? Or is it the unprecedented haste with which his bill is pushed through? Joining us to put this legislation in an historical context is Nancy Kane. Nancy, of course, is an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hey there, Nancy Kane. I see you.
It's always great to be here.
I saw you on a Sunday talk show. Face the Nation. You were fabulous.
Yes,
you
were fabulous.
You were great.
Thank you.
So, Nancy Kane, back in 1913, 16th Amendment, I believe, created permanent income taxes.
Tax, yep.
And since then, we've been fiddling and diddling. That's almost 100 years. Where does this latest fiddle and diddle fit into this?
I think this is more than a fiddle or a diddle. I think this is a pretty momentous piece of fiscal legislation that has much broader effects than just the country's finances. I put it right up there with ERTA, the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981, which was the foundation of supply side economics, what you know critics call trickle down economics. Mm-hmm. Give a lot of money to the wealthy, give a lot of money to businesses, and the extra money will trickle down in the form of jobs and higher incomes for folks less fortunate and less wealthy than large corporations and the wealthiest 1%. That economic logic has been empirically and theoretically decimated over the last 40 years. But ERTA and the rollback of a lot of ERTA, of that tax, which happened in 1983 in something called the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, though that piece of legislation compares in terms of its breadth of impact to this piece of legislation. There was one last big tax bill that was more than fiddle and diddle since Reagan's tax cuts, and that was George W. Bush's tax cut in 2001, as all you folks know very well because you've talked about it. Many of those tax cuts for very wealthy Americans and corporations were rolled back by subsequent by the Obama administration. So we're talking a big exclamation point piece of legislation in the sweep of American tax history.
You know, speaking of context, which I said in the beginning here, is, you know, one of the big debates is it okay to have the top tax, or what is it, 39.5 or whatever it is? Can you give us a little bit of history? I know this will cause Marjorie to be all a Twitter here. give us the history of top income tax rates, like, for example, from World War II through even Ronald Reagan? What were we talking about?
Well, we're talking about rates that have varied as high, higher than well over 70%, the highest rate that I know of historically. And I wrote my master's thesis at the Kennedy School on tax policy, worked, staffed. Staffed at the 1983 piece of legislation for a senator from Colorado when I was working on the Hill as many years ago. But the highest tax bracket for the very top, highest tax rate for the very top bracket was 94%. So for much of the 20th century, we were talking nominal rates, that's before deductions, exemptions, et cetera, nominal rates of 60 to 70%. Right, so the thinking about tax rates at the highest brackets at 40% or a little bit lower is relatively new in the context of the 20th century.
John Kennedy, I think, brought him from the 90s
to the 70s.
And then Ronald Reagan.
And then Lyndon Johnson brought them down to the mid-60s, and then Ronald Reagan brought them down another notch.
Yeah, and what's so interesting about that, and it's not just the only factor, but when you think of the years of great prosperity in the United States, and it wasn't just taxes.
Absolutely.
But it was the post-war, from the 40s right through the 80s, when you could go to college, when you could have dad working and supporting the whole family, and you could buy a house and afford a vacation. Yep. And it's almost as if we just seem to keep repeating the same mistake, and we've just done it again.
This isn't about economic theory. It's not about income distribution, which is one of the important aspects or purposes behind some of the initial legislation to create the income tax, which our listeners will remember was created in 1913 by the 16th Amendment. It had been levied a couple of other times before, but it is made now.
By your guy,
Abraham Lincoln
to fund the Civil War.
Right. I mean, taxes always go up and become very, very important during times of war because the government's spending so much money. Exactly. But in any event, there has been at various moments in American history the idea that the graduated income tax should be an important leveler of incomes. Not leveler, but an engine to generate more income inequality.
Right.
Right. What we've seen in the last, to your point, Marjorie, what we've seen in the last 25 to 30 years is this, as we've talked about many times on this program, and you two have talked about many more times, is this massive increase in income and wealth inequality. And now we have the passage of this tax act, which will exacerbate that significantly in terms of where the benefits flow. So tax policy is never primarily about theory, and it's not always ultimately about practice, about good practice, or even democratic practice, since most Americans are against this, both the House and the Senate bill. It is about politics and power, and there is no question that this bill, on the Senate side and on the House side, still big differences to be reconciled before anything goes to Trump's desk in something called the conference committee, right? That is just beginning to happen. The Senate is sending their bill off to conference. It still remains to be seen what will happen. There is no question that this is legislation designed to benefit the donor classes, right? The people who give the most money to Republican campaigns. That is the primary purpose of this bill. And we are blindsided if we don't look at the very specific economics. I'm happy to talk about a few examples of this if you want.
Yeah, let's hear some few
examples.
Okay,
so here are a couple of examples. And as you just said, Jim, in your intro, the bill became, at least on the Senate side, to a certain extent on the House side, but more obviously on the Senate side, a Christmas tree bill in which lots of ornaments got placed on it at the end very quickly. All of this happened in a very, very rapid fashion, got placed on it. This is not the first time this has happened in tax policy making, to appeal to certain groups. But in terms of the tax piece of this, over the next 10 years, people with incomes between $40,000 and $50,000 will pay $5.3 billion more in taxes. Those with incomes greater than $1 million will pay $5.8 billion less in taxes. That's on the individual income side. So is there good evidence that slashing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20%, that's what both bills do, that's what they both do, will that create more jobs? There's almost no empirical evidence that that will happen. Indeed, in other moments when the corporate tax rate has been cut, the extra income by corporations is used to buy back stock, increase dividends, or move the money overseas so they don't have to pay any, to keep it overseas or move it overseas so they don't have to pay any taxes on it. So it's hard to see this as an economically beneficial piece of legislation, except to the special interests like oil and gas refiners and drillers who will get the benefit of to buy Lisa Murkowski's. Senator Murkowski's vote in Alaska. She's long wanted the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to be open to drilling. That's part of the Senate bill, et cetera. So there's these different pieces that benefit specific groups. But overall, it's hard to see this as something that will benefit the economic well-being of the country.
You know, I'm wondering, it earlier pieces in our history, I would imagine because we hadn't, when Trickle Down came out, in the 80s with Ronald Reagan, it was a fairly new idea to most of us. We didn't know about this. So maybe that's why people fell for it back then. But it is odd that we're falling for it yet a third time. Well, and it's the same lie that we keep believing.
Are we falling for it?
Well, you're right that most people don't.
The polls, which are, of course, very young because this has only just happened really quickly. It didn't happen in what we consider a terribly democratic process.
People aren't taking to the streets. No, it's not like when we had the Women's March.
Well, there have been a few regional and local protests, but no, we're not seeing like the Women's March. We're not seeing scientists lining up, you know, for climate change action, as we did, say, last late winter of this year. We haven't seen that yet. I think there's an interesting question about why, as a people, are we accepting something that most people don't benefit from and that we know will create more income inequality, not to mention a deficit that's $1 trillion. I mean, over time, this is like selling our kids' future off in order that we get the few people in society today get some immediate
benefits.
Selling
off our old age when Medicare gets
absolutely
cut.
So there's a couple of other things to say. So I don't know the answer. Why are we accepting this? I was thinking as I was preparing for this, you know, and Chelsea put together these fabulous stories for us to look at, and I found some others. I was thinking about something Rachel Carson wrote in 1962 at the very beginning of Silent Spring. Have we fallen into a mesmerized state that allows us to accept what we know to be dangerous or detrimental to ourselves and our communities because we have collectively lost the will to demand what is good? And I thought of that line. She's talking about pesticides and the burgeoning, up grassroots interest in what's happening to our water and our air that was sparked partly by DDT's widespread use at that time. But I thought, is that what's happening to us? Have we fallen into some mesmerized state, or we're so busy doing all the things we're doing at, you know, all kinds of pockets of America that we're not clear-eyed taking a look at this? I mean, the ability to raise revenues is why we founded our country. No taxation without representation was a rallying cry for the colonists. There's not a huge amount of representation in this. So why aren't we more incensed? And I don't know the answer, but I think if we want to change something like this, right, and then we have to, and we want to grab back our government. It's hard because, as you folks have talked so eloquently about with many guests, democracy has changed a lot, right? Partly through Citizens United, partly through gerrymandering, partly through all kinds
people
of large...
staying there for
50 years, large structural changes, right? Partly this last election through potentially outside influence in our election. So one person, one vote isn't how the Electoral College always kind of shakes out. So we have democratic challenges to the system, but we still have the right to demand what is good. Yeah. And we're not doing it in large
numbers.
Well,
demand it on social media, which is the lazy man and woman's way to protest.
I think so.
Can we, you know, one thing you would talk about, no taxation without representation. It reminded me of one of the things that Reagan got praised for. Some people like what he did, some people didn't. Is not only was it a lengthy process, much more importantly, it was a bipartisan process.
Yes.
I think, as every listener knows, there was not one Democratic vote for this tax plan, either in the House or Senate. Some may say that's hyper-partisanship, shame on the Democrats, or some may say the Democrats resisted doing the horrible. But the bottom line is there was zero bipartisanship, zero consultation. Is that was Reagan the outlier, or have most of these major tax reform moments or tax cutting, whatever you want to call them, in the last 100 years that Marjorie mentioned, the product of some level of bipartisanship?
The latter, absolutely the latter, Jim. As I know you're intimating, or I'm sure you suspect, absolutely. And I mean, one of the interesting things is I remember this from working on the Hill. I remember this from all the work I did on tax policy. Is how there were the proponents of a specific change in the tax system would be able to talk and use you know, neutral influences like the joint, you know, like the Congressional Budget Office and lots of folks who provide color, if you will, on the effects of tax law, would use those resources to lay out what the trade-offs were for the good of the country. And there was some agreement on this. Okay, we'll take this increase in the deficit in order to do, in order to spend money, raise money this for this for this purpose, or give these kind of tax cuts. We don't see, we now see two very different, starkly different views of what constitutes governance on the part of America. Let me just read you two quotes from two of the supporters of repealing this estate tax, which you all our listeners will know was part of the part of both bills. Big reductions in the burden that people making over $1 million and now up to $11 million worth $11 million face in terms of passing their money on to their children. So this is from Charles Grassley, Iowa, one of Iowa's senators. "I think not having the estate tax recognizes that the people that are investing," Grassley said, "as opposed to those who are just spending every darn penny they have, whether it's on booze or women or movies." And then here's Utah's Orrin Hatch, another senator, from, one of the senators from Utah. "I have a rough time wanting to spend billions and billions and trillions of dollars to help people who won't help themselves, won't lift a finger, and expect the federal government to do everything." So, you know, we have a government, we have a group of legislators who think that government's responsibility is to help the very wealthy, and a group of legislators who see it differently, and some in the middle, like Susan Collins, right, who had her votes
so
bought off.
Me too. In her.
Me too.
She
many
my
of us are.
Heroine.
Jeff Flake, right, who also had his vote bought off by potentially some action on Dreamers and DACA. That probably won't happen, at least last report, et cetera. So and so we see, again, two very competing, one very, very harsh, one a policy of relative indifference to those that don't make $1 million a year, and everyone who makes less, and a very different vision for America from the Democrats and some Republicans and generally most Americans. Three other things for our listeners to think.
We only have a minute.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Quickly, three things. The God is in the details in this in both these bills. So if you're interested, and if you're anything in this conversation has piqued your interest as a voter and a citizen, you need to find out about some of the things that are likely to happen. For example, tuition for graduate students is entirely likely to be taxed, tuition aid, right? Adding tens of thousands of dollars to graduate student tax bills, right? The mandate for insurance under Obamacare may indeed be repealed. Right, a ban on churches being involved in political activity, which was put in place in 1954, was relinquished in the House bill that may likely stay in place for the final bill. So there are all kinds, separation of churches. So there are all kinds of details here that are worth a little bit of time and attention.
Amen.
Nancy Cain, thank you very much. That was terrific as always. Nancy Cain joins us every week. She's a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds a James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, and it is terrific, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. You have a whole section there about Rachel Carson. Nancy, thank you. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Congressman Richard Neal will be here with us, our national security expert Juliette Kayyem and Sue O'Connell. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Molly Boygon, Christina Bieni, and our engineer, John McClaw Parker. We are a production of WGBH. Jim Browdy, what's on TV?
Well, I should first say, Richie Neal is not just another congressman from Massachusetts. He's the chief Democrat on the tax writing committee, even though he was kept out as well. So no one knows more about this on the Democratic side than him. Kevin Cullen has written columns in the Boston Globe saying stepping aside temporarily by Stan Rosenberg is not enough. And then there is State Senator Linda Dorsina-Forey. They're both going to join me tonight to talk about the latest on Stan Rosenberg, the Conyers resignation, and why there are arbitrary differences between how some politicians survive or don't survive these kind of scandals. Emerson College President Lee Pelton on the impact of the tax plan on universities, on education, the travel ban on higher ed. Christina Quinn is going to talk a little bit about what we didn't get to talk to John Rosenthal about, the program out of Gloucester, which is going national for those who are addicted. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Donald Trump's feeding habits. That's all tonight at Greater Boston at 7 o'clock.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a lovely afternoon. Keep out of the rain.